Chapter 17. It had taken days to cajole her father into supporting the weekend. Not that Justine Benelli actually wanted him there. Not as he was, right now, barely 6 months out of rejuve. He was impossible at the best of times, but add his natural brute stubbornness to youthful vitality and it made him damn near inhuman. However, she had to concede, his presence made the weekend a valid event. Without him, the necessary players would never have turned up. They'd chosen to have it at Sorbonne Wood, the family's West Coast retreat, a big estate outside Seattle, with fast-flowing rivers and extensive woodland hemmed in by mountains. She would have preferred a weekend at the Tulip Mansion, the family's primary home over on the East Coast. It was so much more civilized than this rustic sanctuary, but the informal gathering that the Bernellis were hosting was to be discreet above all else. People started arriving mid-afternoon on the Friday. Justine had been there a day already, overseeing the personal preparations, something she never quite entrusted to her staff for get-togethers at this level. Sorbonne Wood consisted of a large main house, originally of stone and concrete, which was now thoroughly covered by dry coral, one of the oldest examples on Earth. It had been planted over 2 centuries ago. The 2 native colors of lavender and beige that grew up the walls and across the roof seemed insipid compared to the modern varieties that GM had made available. Their braided fronds also suffered from poor texture, with older sections susceptible to crumbling. So the ground staff encouraged constant growth. By now the fronds were a foot thicker than the house's original walls, which made the big picture windows appear organic, they were so sunken. The UFN's environment commissioners would doubtless impose a removal order and a hefty fine on anyone else who was impudent enough to cultivate the alien plant to such an extent, but no mere EC official was ever going to get through Sorbonne Wood's security perimeter. The interior of the main house was made up of various reception rooms, relaxation facilities, and the dining rooms. Family members and guests stayed in any of the dozen lodges arranged in a semicircle around the rear gardens and linked to the main house by rose-covered pergola walks. On the outside, at least, these satellite buildings made an attempt to conform with local heritage. They had log walls and bark slate roofs, although the interiors were strictly 24th century in terms of furnishings and convenience. Gore Benelli was the first to arrive, driving up under the wide gullwing porch canopy in a huge black Zill limousine. Even though it was electric, Justine thought the six-wheeled monster must surely violate some kind of environmental laws. It was so heavy and twice the size of her own current Jaguar coupe. 3 other big sedans pulled in behind it, carrying members of her father's retinue, and her e-butler told her another 2 had gone straight to the estate's little staff village. Justine stepped forward to greet the old tyrant king as the Zill's rear door opened and its ground steps slid out. 2 assistants, doubling as bodyguards, emerged first, looking like traditional mobsters in their sleek black suits and silver-band glasses. Justine showed no emotion at their appearance. They weren't needed here, and her father knew that. In fact, he was probably wet-wired to be a lot more lethal than they could ever be. His last rejuvenation at the family's biogenic center had taken longer than usual. Gore Benelli appeared in the Zill's doorway, sniffing the air.
"Goddamn, Seattle. Goddamn raining again," he grunted.
A light drizzle misted the sky, making the edges of the gullwing canopy drip constantly over the conifers planted around it.
"Don't know why we don't just move this fucking place over to England. Same weather, better beer."
Justine gave him a gentle hug. "Stop it, Dad. This weekend is going to be tough enough for me as it is, without having to keep you in order." He made an attempt to grin back at her. It wasn't an easy gesture for him, not with that face. She could still see his native human features. As a normal 20-year-old, he would have been strikingly handsome. His thick fair hair was already starting to curl mischievously as it sprouted vigorously from the short crew cut he'd come out of the tank with, but the sheer number and complexity of his ock tattoos meant that they had merged together and now completely covered his face, giving him 24-carat golden skin like the sarcophagus mask of an ancient Egyptian king.
"Like I dare complain with you riding my ass." How's Mom?
Gore rolled his eyes. They at least appeared normal.
How the fuck should I know? You tell me who she was. I erased the memory centuries ago.
Liar.
Justine saw the bodyguard stiffen slightly. They probably weren't used to anyone talking to their boss like this. But then Justine was Gore's firstborn, conceived and born entirely naturally, unlike the 50-odd children that had followed her and her brother. Back then, Gore had been a mere billionaire, inheriting the wealth of two distinguished old-money American families as his parents joined in dynastic union. With some astute judgments and predictions, and not a little political influence, his original extensive portfolios had grown in tandem with the human expansion into Phase One space. The Bernellis, like all of Earth's grand families, were living proof that money breeds money. Dawson Knight, the legal, accountancy, and management firm that was the core of the family financial empire, was staffed almost entirely by family members. Its raison d'etre was accumulating more wealth and protecting that which already existed. The Bernellis had holdings on every planet in the Commonwealth, from acres of strategic real estate around the outskirts of Phase 3 space capital cities to entire blocks of manufacturing capacity on each of the Big 15, from transport and retail companies to banks, utilities, and cutting-edge startup enterprises. Anything that did or would one day turn a profit, they took a slice early in the game. Justine had played a huge part in building the family fortune over the centuries, performing nearly every role from troubleshooter in the early decades to chief acquisition negotiator, and more lately a subtle political broker. Not that she ever favored the more public political role her brother took. But despite all that, all the dealing, the maneuvering, the manipulation that she'd carried out over the long centuries, it was Gore who remained the sacrosanct heart of the ever-increasing Bernelli family.
"Well, I saw Mom a month ago," Justine said. "She sends her love."
"She's not coming here, is she?"
Gore suddenly shifted his focus. As always, his virtual vision surrounded him with financial displays, news précis, and market reports from Dawson Knight, looking to buy options, futures, land, currency. If there was an opportunity to advantage the family, he'd take it.
"No, you're safe here," Justine said.
"Good. I'm going to my lodge. But I want to see you and your brother before any of the horse trading starts this evening."
"I'll tell Thompson when he gets here."
Gore and his retinue of bodyguards, assistants, and aides walked into the main house. A couple of beautiful Oriental girls brought up the rear of the procession, wearing tight white micro-dresses. They were twins, or reprofiled to look identical. Both of them bowed respectfully as they passed Justine, who just managed not to scowl back at them. In some respects, her father could be terribly predictable. The girls would be slotted into his schedule the same way as a finance conference or a meal. Every minute of his day was worked into his personal agenda weeks in advance. She knew a lot of people speculated that he'd received illegal psychoneural profiling to turn him into an obsessive-compulsive about work and the family. But she still possessed the memories of her early childhood, when he was rarely home from Wall Street before 10 or 11 in the evening, spending every weekend in his study with computer screens as his only companions. He'd always been single-minded, keeping human requirements to the minimum. As technology advanced, so he acquired more and more interface and processing functions to keep him attuned to the great pan-Commonwealth financial markets. Half an hour after Gore arrived, Campbell Sheldon drove up to Sorbonne Wood. Justine greeted him with a genuine enough smile. He was one of Nigel's great-great-grandchildren, the youngest of three brothers from a direct lineage granddaughter. That gave him a lot of seniority within the Sheldon family, and as he'd chosen a CST career, he'd achieved a high-ranking position as the Director for Advanced Civil and Commercial Projects. Though Nigel was quite adamant that being family only ever got your foot on the bottom of the ladder, from there you had to move up on merit. Campbell had a couple of aides with him, but that was all. Justine remembered enjoying that no-fuss attitude the previous time they'd met. Today, Campbell was halfway between rejuvenations, giving him an apparent age in his 40s.
A trim mouse-brown beard covered cheeks that were slightly chubby. He definitely had inherited some of Nigel's characteristics. The deep eyes, small nose, darkening blonde hair. A few discreet platinum oak tattoos spiraled behind and below his ears. He kissed her lightly on both cheeks and said, "You're looking fabulous." "Thank you. I think I was just about due for rejuve the last time we met. The party on the Muang Senator's yacht, if I remember rightly. The Braby Bridge opening ceremony." They had airfish floating over the yacht like yellow balloons. "Oh, Lord, you are terribly well briefed. I can see I'm going to have to spend all night updating myself." "I hope not all night. That would be a waste of an evening." "Ah, I remember this part of you very well." Her gesture invited him into the hall. "What can I say? I'm a Sheldon. I have a reputation to keep up. Weren't you with that rock singer that time on the yacht?" "Ah, the dear Callisto. We parted company not long after, I'm afraid. She left me for a drummer. She named herself after a moon." He shrugged. "It was fashionable back then." "So what is now? Asteroids? Comets?" Campbell laughed, then paused to look at the house. "Is that really dry coral? On Earth?" "Yes. Please don't report us to the feds. It's older than most of our family members. I'm easily bribed. A quiet late-night drink. Bathing together in romantic candlelight. Making love in a four-poster bed." Justine smiled back. "I'll certainly consider a plunge in a mountain stream with you. We have several in the grounds." "My God, you're a sadist. In Washington State in springtime? Do you have any idea what water that cold will do to a man?" "I'm game to find out if you are." "Okay, but I certainly expect that drink later on. What's the form for the weekend?"
"Strictly informal. The main decision on the Starflight Agency has already been taken by the Exo-Protectorate Council. All that's left are a few policy shakedowns to get things working smoothly before the Senate confirmation. If I might suggest, this gives you an excellent opportunity to explore options with Patricia Cantill."
"Huh," Campbell grunted. "She's coming, is she?"
"Oh, yes."
Patricia Cantill was actually the next to arrive, stepping out of a mid-price range Ford Ocklet, wearing a neat office suit, also off the shelf, and classic black pumps. She kept an apparent age in her mid-50s, mature enough to be trustworthy, not so old as to be losing any intellectual capacity. A web of silver oak tattoos radiated out from her eyes, so thin they were invisible most of the time. Her hairstyle and makeup carefully emphasized her Latin ethnicity. Justine could tell she spent a lot of money on that salon styling, but voters wouldn't be able to tell that as she stood one pace behind her boss, Elaine Doy. The fact that Doy's chief political advisor was spending a weekend in Seattle barely 10 days after the vice president had announced her candidacy was a telling point to Justine. For Patricia, these 2 days would be a major lobbying exercise. She'd brought her secretary with her, a studious young man, dressed in the kind of designer casuals an urban type always wore in the great outdoors. He stood attentively behind his chief, only ever speaking when spoken to. Justine was busy welcoming them when a third person emerged from the ocklet, a young girl with long blonde hair, actually taller and slimmer than Justine. Her clothes were unashamedly expensive, a short skirt and shiny gold V-neck top that highlighted her figure. She glanced around the grounds with the unique, bubbly exuberance that spelled First Lifer, smiling broad approval at what she saw.
"And this is Isabella," Patricia said, "my companion." "Hi there, you have a lovely place here," Isabella gushed.
She stuck her hand out eagerly, wanting to make friends.
"Thank you," Justine said. "It took a while, but we've gotten it how we like it."
It would be so easy to shower Isabella with sarcasm and irony, the girl would never notice. But that would make her a bitch, and this weekend didn't need any ructions.
"Get me a full file on her," Justine told her e-butler. Something about her features was familiar enough to make Justine cautious.
Isabella was obviously from a grand family or an intersolar dynasty, but which? Isabella Helena Halgarth, Justine's Eve Butler reported, aged 19. Second daughter of Victor and Bernadette Halgarth. A small file printed down inside her virtual vision, detailing Isabella's schools, academic achievements, sports, interests, charitable causes. The usual PR crap the family released on its own. Damn it. As soon as she'd shown Patricia to her lodge, Justine put a call through to Estella Fenton. I need some information. Darling, I'm humbled and honored, Estella said teasingly. What on earth do I know that your family doesn't? It's about this girl. Justine's virtual finger touched an icon, sending Estella the small file on Isabella. You're the queen of gossip. I need to know what her true standing is in the Halgarths. If it was anyone else asking, I'd resent that, Estella said. Please, I know the status of nearly every grand family member, but the Halgarths are an intrasolar dynasty. I know, darling. Nouveau riche off-worlders, the worst kind. I've got my own profile of her here. What exactly do you want to know? Is she considered important? Not really. 15th generation, and Victor was only 11. Both father and daughter were in vitro gestated children, so they're not direct lineage, just filling the family quota. She's got a minimal trust fund. It pays enough so she doesn't have to work, but she can't quite afford to live a society high life. She finished school last year and hasn't yet chosen a university. In fact, word has it that when she's rejuved, she might go for a little brain resequencing. Her IQ isn't exactly lighting the top of the Christmas tree. Had a few boyfriends, all of equally minor status, and currently sleeping with... Oh, Patricia Cantill. Is this why you're calling? Yes. I've got some senior Halgarths coming this weekend. I don't know if Patricia secured their vote. It might be a problem if they interpret the relationship incorrectly. Rest easy, darling. You didn't hear this from me, but Edinburgh is already lining up behind Doy. That makes 6 of the Big 15. I don't think Patricia and Isabella will be a factor for you. The Halgarths are backing Doy after all. Congratulations, you are better connected than me. Thanks. I really don't need last-minute scares like this. I owe you. You certainly do. Next time I need an A-list grandee for dinner, I'll be there. Gerhard Utreff was next, a fourth-generation member of the Brandt family that had founded the Democratic Republic of New Germany. As an attorney, he'd opted out of the family's management and financial side to work in the planetary legal office. Decades ago, he'd been the DRNG's Commonwealth Senator. He'd even been married to a Benelli at one time, resulting in 2 in vitro gestated children. Not that Justine expected that to count for much during the weekend, but it made him a good potential ally. She had also invited Larry Frederick Halgarth, who was in the 3rd generation of his dynasty. He arrived with Raphael Columbia, who was an inevitable addition to the weekend. But when the invitation was issued, Larry had also insisted on bringing Natasha Kersley, who shared the limo with the other 2. When Justine ran her name through the Benelli database, she drew a blank. Natasha wasn't a member of any major family, nor had Justine ever heard of the Commonwealth Special Science Supervisory Directorate, of which Natasha was the chief executive. All Larry would say was, it conducts theoretical studies of weapons, exotic weapons. There were 2 more senators to complete the weekend gathering. Crispin Goldreich, whose position on the Commonwealth Budget Commission gave him a great deal of influence over the start-up arrangements of the whole Starflight agency project. Justine's briefing had him down as a mild skeptic, but as she knew, there was really no such political animal. He was fishing for something. Finally, there was Ramon D.B., the senator for Bhutta, although remarkably he didn't belong to the Mandela family that had established that Big 15 world. Instead, he was the leader of the General African Caucus in the Senate, which gave him a respectable power base. He had also been Justine's husband for 12 years, but that was 8 decades ago. "Remember me?" she asked coyly as he got out of his car. He just wrapped his arms around her, hugging tightly. Damn,
You look hot when you're this age, he rumbled softly.
He held her at arm's length, looking her up and down. A wistful expression crossed his face.
Can we get married again?
It was her turn to look at him. His traditional robe had a wonderful rainbow hem of semi-organic fiber that kept swirling as if he were in a breeze. Not even that movement could entirely disguise the way it fell over his stomach. His apparent age was approaching 60, with white hairs infiltrating his temple. Midnight black ock tattoos ran across his cheeks, flickering in and out of visibility.
How much weight are you carrying under there? She asked.
He put his hands together in prayer and appealed to the sky.
Once a wife, always a wife. I keep in shape.
What shape? A beach ball? Rami, you know you have trouble with your heart when you put on this much weight.
It is the fate of senators to attend huge meals every day of the week. I expect you'll be sitting us down for an 8-course dinner tonight.
You are definitely not having 8 courses. And I'm going to talk to the chef about your diet for the rest of the weekend. I don't want to have to visit you in a real-life procedure ward, Rami.
Yes, yes, woman. I am due to rejuve soon. It will all be sorted out then. Stop worrying.
Have they got a specific retro sequence for your condition yet?
He gave an impatient swish of his fly whisk.
I have rare genes. It is difficult for doctors to isolate the problem and correct it.
Then have them vector in a sequence for a new heart. It's simple enough.
I am what I am. You know that. I don't want somebody else's heart.
She gathered a breath, ready to sigh at him. Before she had a chance, his thick forefinger came up under her chin.
Don't scold me, Justine. It is so good to see you again.
Being a senator isn't nearly as wonderful as everyone claims. I was hoping we could spend a little time together, you and I, this weekend.
We will.
She patted his arm. I want to talk to you about Abby, anyway.
What's up with our great-grandchild now?
Later. She read the clock in her virtual vision. I have to check in with Dad and Thompson before the evening begins for real.
Your father is here.
Ramon was suddenly reluctant to get closer to the house.
Yes.
Is that a problem?
You know he never liked me.
That's your insecurity and imagination. He always accepted you.
Like a lion accepts a wildebeest.
Justine burst out laughing. You're a senator of the Commonwealth, and he still intimidates you.
He took her arm and walked into the entrance hall. I will smile at him and make polite conversation for exactly 3 minutes. If you don't rescue me by then, I'll...
Yes?
Put you over my knee.
Ah, hark the heavenly angels as they sing glad tidings. The good old days are back in town.
Gore Benelli had decompressed his parallel personality into Soban Wood's large array, settling himself into the house as other humans would return to a comfortable old armchair. Unlike most humans who underwent frequent rejuvenation, he didn't dump his memories into a secure store for nostalgia's sake. He carried them around with him in high-density inserts, loading them into local arrays wherever he went. They were essential to him. To make the deals that gave his family a smooth ride into the future, he had to have the knowledge of past deals and the reasoning behind them, if they'd worked, what the problems were. Others, like his daughter, relied on briefings and extensive database access through an e-butler. While he had the real events immediately available, thanks to the homogenized access programs that his early memories were rooted to. Business and positioning the family in the market were his constant now. Technology made it possible for him to be involved for most of the day. Some of the routines he'd developed for managing the process were almost autonomous, allowing him to parallel multitask. Even now, as he watched his son and daughter enter Soban Wood's big classical library, he was reviewing the deluge of data that fell between them like red digital rain. Figures and headlines briefly flared green as his virtual fingers flashed among them, rearranging them into new configurations, shunting money and information to form the new deals and purchases.
Everybody's here, Justine told him. He made no comment. That information had long since flowed past him. The house was now updating him on the location of the guests and their aides and staff and spouses and lovers. Who was using the showers and baths? Who was using heavy and heavily encrypted bandwidth to the Unisphere? Who was walking along the pergola paths to the main house, ready for pre-dinner drinks in the Magnolia Lounge? Secondary information like that was now presented to his brain in the form of scent. The multitude of Ock tattoos allowing him to smell where the guests were and what they were up to. "I think these guests provide us with a critical mass," Thompson said. "As long as there aren't any unforeseen problems, it should go smoothly."
"That's self-evident, boy," Gore snapped. "But there are always problems.
I'm relying on you two to anticipate them and massage them out of those grossly bloated egos gathering out there." "The only possible glitch so far was Isabella," Justine said, "but she won't register on the Halgarth radar. Just another trust babe having herself some first life fun. I don't think Patricia had an ulterior motive for sleeping with her." Thompson dropped down in one of the winged leather armchairs in front of the big fireplace. "Not like Patricia to take any sort of risk. The girls she normally fucks are completely sanitized as far as political connections are concerned." "Maybe it's true love," Justine said in amusement. "That'd be a first," Thompson said. "Why the hell Patricia doesn't simply get a body reassignment when she's in rejuve, I'll never know."
"She can't," Gore said. "Most of Doy's team are female.
It's an image she's worked hard at for 25 years. Nobody's going to screw that up now by growing a dick in the tank. Speaking of which, we haven't officially declared for her yet," Thompson said.
"That can happen this weekend," Gore said, "if the timing is right.
For that, I'll require confirmation of Doy's policy on the Starflight Agency startup. Assuming she's going to back it, and she'd be a stupid bitch if she didn't, I want us to pay particular attention to the structure which is going to emerge. This weekend will give the family a big advantage on positioning when the agency is announced. Those details will matter." "The agency is temporary," Thompson said. "It's the Navy we need to concentrate on."
"I know. That's where we come in."
"What if we don't need a Navy?" Justine asked.
"We will," Gore said firmly. "I happen to agree with Sheldon and Keim on this one. The Dyson aliens shoot first and ask questions later. That tells me all I need to know about them."
"Even if it's just for deterrence value, the Commonwealth is going to need warships. Government will be spending money on procurement, a lot of money. We have to ensure the family gets a slice of that."
"Easy enough," Thompson said.
"God fuck!" Gore closed a golden hand into a fist. "Don't you ever fucking learn? All the other grands are maneuvering right now. Justine was right to put this weekend together for us. If we can influence the shape, our placing will be unmatched."
"What sort of shape do you want?"
"The main one has got to be location. Get Sheldon to let go of that hillbilly backwood, Anshun. I want the agency centered at the High Angel, where it damn well should have been all along. The family has a lot of interest in the Astro Engineering Company's base there. A real shipbuilding program will see their stock go through the roof."
"We can probably make that sound logical," Justine said.
"It is logical. What we need is a way to make it serve their interests."
"I'll work on it," she promised. Gore turned back to Thompson. "The other side to the Navy is going to be the planetary defenses. Don't allow that to be overlooked this weekend. People are going to want damn great force fields guarding their cities and making them feel safe. I can see that ultimately chewing up even more cash than the starships."
"Okay. I'll keep that one on the agenda," Thompson said.
Dinner was the kind of formal event that Justine could sleepwalk through in her official role as hostess. They held it in the main dining room, with broad church-like arched windows looking out across gardens illuminated by thousands of twinkling white fairy stars. She made sure Campbell was at one end of the long oak table with her father, while she chatted away to Patricia at the other end. Isabella didn't join them for dinner. "She finds these things a little dull, I'm afraid," Patricia said as the band started playing some background jazz.
"She's young,"
Justine said sympathetically.
You did well getting her to come along at all.
It was the names. She's a bit of a fame junkie, Patricia admitted, as she bit into her starter of cannelloni of smoked salmon. Right now she's accessing murderous seduction. It's the penultimate episode. Isn't that a biog drama of the last Mayo case?
Yes, a bit melodramatic for me, but the lead character is sort of her age, and it's a good production.
I wish I had time to keep up on pop culture. I'm surprised you do, especially right now. Part of the job is coaxing various celebrity endorsements, among others. Her smile was polite, but 100% professional. Our family is very supportive of the Starship Agency proposal, hence this weekend.
I know, and Elaine is very appreciative of that. Will she be making it part of her platform?
Justine looked down the length of the table, straight at her father's expressionless gold face.
It's a bit radical, but then the Dyson mission has injected a few new factors into today's politics. The agency needs to go ahead. Elaine knows that. She's prepared to go out on a limb, if that's what it takes.
Gore Benelli gave a tiny nod. Our family will certainly do whatever we can to support her position this weekend, Justine said.
I'm very grateful for that help. Patricia couldn't quite conceal her predatory smile as she took another mouthful of the rolled salmon.
Justine studiously avoided any more verbal fencing with Patricia for the rest of the evening. The meal wasn't the time for the serious negotiations to start in earnest. Instead, the three Benellis made sure they talked to everyone separately at some point, preparing them for tomorrow. It began in earnest at breakfast. The staff had set up an extensive buffet in the conservatory on the side of the main house, and Justine came over early to join Patricia and Crispin Goldreich at a table. Crispin's two wives, Lady Mary and Countess Sophia, were still in their lodge taking breakfast in bed, though one of his aides sat beside him, pouring tea and fetching food from the buffet. Patricia's immaculate young man was doing the same thing for her. One of the house staff brought a pot of Jamaican coffee for Justine. She sat next to Crispin as he ate his eggs Benedict. It was the less confrontational position. She wanted to know the same things as Patricia, and Crispin was hugely influential. In addition to his leadership of the Budget Commission, he held a lot of authority among the bloc of European affiliate planets.
Thompson told me you were one of the more moderate voices on the council meeting, Justine said.
Cautious would be the more accurate word, my dear. I've been in this game long enough to spot an open-ended commitment. If this agency is approved by the Senate, there is no knowing how long taxpayers will be required to fund the endeavor. It won't end with the Dyson flights, you know. If they turn out to be benign, there will be a precedent in place for government to fund exploration of other questionable unknowns, which is surely better than having it done by a private company. Patricia said.
We've all heard the rumors of closed planets, worlds which have something so valuable the Sheldons have kept it for themselves.
And you believe that? Crispin asked.
Not personally, no. But I do believe that the government should be more involved with the investigation of potentially hazardous scenarios, such as the Dyson pair. For that we need the Starflight Agency. After all, the Dyson pair is the very first time we've found anything remotely threatening. And it's a big galaxy. So far, we've been lucky. We have to start being more cautious.
Which brings us to this dratted Navy proposal, Crispin said.
You can't deny that would be essential if the Dyson scouting mission proves them hostile.
No, I don't. But the expenditure for that will be orders of magnitude above a Starflight agency.
So how would you like to see this managed? Patricia asked.
Crispin took a moment to finish the last of his eggs Benedict. With a greater degree of responsibility, he said eventually.
At the moment, we're simply throwing money at the problem. The first thing I'd like to see is some proper channeling of resources.
You mean some kind of oversight committee? Justine asked. In her virtual vision, a calendar was displaying the date 2 years hence when Crispin's senatorial seat was up for re-election. He'd get it again if he wanted it. That wasn't a problem. But of course, if he's to carry on as chair of the Budget Commission, he would need to be nominated by the executive.
Oversight, management, steering, call it what you like. We have to ensure the resources are spent properly, Your budget commission has it within its purview to set up such an oversight body, Patricia said. Technically, yes. Unless the executive starts throwing up obstacles. I'm sure the president's office would want to maintain a tight control over the agency, and certainly the Navy. Of course. But Elaine would be in favor of legitimate financial scrutiny. She absolutely does not want taxpayers' money wasted, and I know she has a lot of confidence in the way you run the budget commission. I'm delighted to hear that, Crispin said. He poured himself some tea. In which case, providing the budget commission can get those financial safeguards in place, Elaine Doy would have my support for the agency, if she gets elected. If she gets elected, Patricia parroted, keeping a composed face. Crispin is on board, Justine told her father. Good work. What did it cost? Patricia gave him the budget commission leadership after Doy's elected. There could be worse people in charge. Crispin is an old hack, but at least he understands the rules of the game. Well done. What's next? Utrecht. Thompson's with him after breakfast. It stopped raining after breakfast, leaving the grounds glistening from the overnight soaking. Thompson led his guest past the formal gardens and into the woods beyond. They were a mixture of pine and beech and silver birch, not as densely planted as they had been during the logging centuries when they'd been all pine. As Washington State was now edging into springtime, a multitude of bulbs were pushing through the sandy soil, their verdure leaves contrasting with the mat of brownish winter grass that was still pressed against the ground from the weight of snow that had lain on it for months. Gerhard Utrecht seemed to be enjoying the mock wild environment. He'd even brought his own walking boots. Every time I visit the West Coast, I always promise myself I'll take a day and go to look at the sequoias, the Democratic Republic of New Germany senator said. And have you? Thompson asked. No, not once in 150 years. You should. I went about 50 years ago. They're quite a sight. Ah, well, maybe next time. They reached one of the streams that had cut a deep, narrow cleft through the soil. It's perfectly clear water now running over a bed of white and grey stones. Thompson started to follow it up the shallow slope, avoiding the big tufts of dark green reed grass sprouting from the sodden banks. I congratulate your family on getting a Sheldon as important as Campbell under the same roof as Doy's chief political adviser. The weight which your father's name still carries is remarkable. It's not in anyone's interest to have warring factions at the heart of government. We do what we can. Of course, I have to admit, I don't remember a vice president launching a campaign without the support of at least 7 of the Big 15 dynasties. Doy's own caution works against her at this level. You really can't please all of the people all of the time. She's been trying to do that for too long. It's not that she's gained enemies. She simply hasn't gathered much in the way of admiration. And if I may ask, how does the Bernelli family view her? No differently to any other presidential candidate. There are many flaws and some strengths. However, our principal interest lies in the events which will play out during her presidential term. We heartily endorse the formation of a Starflight agency. Doy did have the foresight to make the initial proposal in the Exo-Protectorate Council. Is that the view of the Grand Families as well? The majority, yes. We will be campaigning on her behalf. I see. Thompson stopped where the stream opened out into a wider pool. The far end was fed by a small waterfall gushing over an antagonistic cluster of sharp stones, making a loud sloshing sound as the flow was tossed around. I'd appreciate knowing what it would take to bring you in. Gerhard nodded slowly, appreciative they were using straight talk for once. It didn't happen often between senators. Everyone is concentrating on the agency and constructing scout ships right now, which is understandable. However, it is the view of the Democratic Republic that the formation of a navy is almost inevitable. We concur with that. If a navy is formed, flying, scouting, and even attack missions will only be a part of its duty. It must defend the Commonwealth as well. Sheldon has a monopoly on the ships and their FTL technology, which we would not dream of challenging. But planets and cities will need heavy fortifications.
That is where we envisage our role to lie. You would be happy backing the agency formation on that understanding?
Yes, we would.
That would mean lining up with Doi.
Like you, we acknowledge she has weaknesses, though, like her strengths, none of them are particularly remarkable. I suspect history will regard her tenure as simply adequate. The age of great statesmen and women is long behind us. Nowadays we just compromise our way through life. The Democratic Republic can live with that.
Good call by Gerhardt, Gore acknowledged. The data flow engulfing him began to flash like a thunderstorm as his virtual hands rearranged packages and icons for long-term positioning in the Democratic Republic of New Germany.
He's a professional, Thompson said. The DRNG realizes the agency will go ahead. They just want to weigh in.
A late opening is better than none at all.
I wonder what the Sheldons will make of that.
They'll accommodate it. They know damn well they can't expect the entire agency budget for Augusta.
That's why they sent Campbell. He's fourth generation. He probably won't even have to refer back to Nigel for anything that comes up this weekend.
We'll find out soon enough. It's the Crux meeting next.
Patricia was invited to the study first. Gore's retinue had done what they could to make the room more welcoming. A real log fire was burning away in the grate, helping to banish the afternoon's chilly breeze. The ancient brown leather Chesterfield sofas had been arranged in front of the hearth. A table standing in the middle held pots of tea and coffee, as well as plates of muffins and cookies, filling the air with a pleasant aroma. She accepted a bone china cup of tea and sat opposite Gore. She wasn't particularly unnerved by him. She'd spent enough time with the super-rich to know what they wanted above all else was a show of respect. His gold face, however, was disturbing. Most of her life was spent judging and responding to expressions. Gore offered her little clue about his emotions. That's if he has any, she thought.
It looks like the Democratic Republic will be backing Elaine, Gore said.
Patricia kept herself as immobile as she could, though it was difficult. The relief she felt at hearing of Gerhardt's support was enormous. When she thought of all the time spent lobbying him, the team of researchers analyzing what they could do to bring him on board, now just half a day spent with the Benellis and another Big 15 was supporting Elaine. For over a year, Patricia had been frantic with worry about how few of the intersolar dynasties they'd managed to gather in their favor.
That's excellent news, sir.
You haven't heard their price yet. Gore went on to explain what assurance she'd have to give the DRNG senator before the end of the weekend.
But the real key is Sheldon, he said. This agency and everything it will lead to is your first way in. I know you've been courting that dynasty for over 3 years now.
They have proved somewhat reluctant, she acknowledged.
Ha! Gore's shiny gold lips parted in a recognizable sneer.
Nigel hates careerist politicians. Comes from his right-on youth, I expect. That's why he's kept you dangling. But he's learned to be a pragmatist over the centuries, and now you can offer him something. It is possible for him to maneuver his own candidate into the presidency, even at this late date. However, that would cost a lot of time and effort and create antagonisms. Now, with you, that wouldn't even register. But the intersolar dynasties and grand families would be pissed with him. That he does care about.
So, be what he wants, and you'll have no opposition.
Are you prepared to do that?
We can take Augusta's requirements into account during the campaign.
Gore stared at her for a moment.
There is only one requirement right now. Money. You'll be embarking on a campaign that will ultimately raise taxes. That's never going to be popular.
I understand.
Patricia hesitated.
Won't you be hit by taxes?
If we paid any serious ones, we probably would be.
One of Gore's overlarge, dark-suited bodyguards led Campbell into the study. He smiled pleasantly at Patricia as he sat beside her.
You two kids play nice now, Gore said.
The study fire had burned down low when Justine and Thompson came in.
Two of the house staff were clearing away the paraphernalia of afternoon tea under the cautious gaze of the bodyguards. Gore took a couple of pine logs from the wicker basket at the side of the hearth and dropped them into the cast-iron grate, which kicked up a small cloud of sparks from the bright pink embers. "It's going to work," he told his two children. "Sheldon will back Doy's candidacy."
"What did that cost her?"
Justine asked. "Billions," Gore said, "in taxpayer money. Even I was surprised by what she offered for the Starflight Agency's first budget. She'll look for a jumper to introduce the bill. Someone who's leaving the Senate," Thompson said. "If Patricia's got any sense, she'll try and get the president to introduce the agency formation bill into the Senate himself. That way, Doy won't get the blame when the budget is announced."
"She'll get blamed when the Navy starts up,"
Justine said. "If we need a Navy, no one is going to question the cost. Christ, she might even make a second term."
"Did you tell Campbell we want to shift the agency base to High Angel?"
Thompson asked. "No, someone else can do our dirty work." Gore looked at Justine. "I thought your ex would fit the bill."
She groaned and flopped down into the Chesterfield.
"Why him?" "That way we can offer Buddha the new High Angel shipyard assembly contracts. It fits perfectly. Sheldon will know he's got to accommodate everyone else."
Justine glanced at her clock display. "All right. We've got an hour before pre-dinner cocktails. I'll sound him out."
"I thought you'd talked to him already today," Thompson asked.
"Yes, but that was about Abby. She's being a problem."
"Is she all right?" Gore asked. "I haven't received any information."
The immediate interest amused Justine. He really was protective of the family, especially the direct lineage.
"This wouldn't reach you. We were just talking about which university she's going to. I wanted Yale. She and her mother would like Oxford, and Rami favors Johannesburg." "It'll be Oxford," Gore said. "You always cave in to your offspring."
Cocktails were served in the music room. It was a large split-level room on the ground floor, with a central dais of teak for the ancient Steinway piano. The woman they'd hired to play the beautiful antique for the evening was from the San Francisco Civic Orchestra. She had an admirable repertoire and a mellow voice. After hearing her start with an Elton John classic, Thompson was almost reluctant to take Ramon, Patricia, and Crispin down to the other end of the room, where they stood in front of a Harkins waterflow sculpture that took up most of the wall. Crispin wasn't part of the deal to be made, but as he was now on Doy's team, he would be useful in providing assurance to Ramon. The more players were tied together, the harder it was for them to renege. "You have to admit," Thompson said to his ex-brother-in-law, "having Chairwoman Gall on your side would be a big help within the African caucus. A great many of your members respect her. It wouldn't be just you trying to swing the proposition. You could share the load."
"That woman is a total ball breaker," Ramon said dismissively. "I think you're making a mistake including her in this without any prior consultation. And she's only a very loose member of the Senate's African caucus. When it suits her is the usual membership criteria."
"She's got to want the agency to be based at High Angel," Crispin said. "I know she was most unhappy when the second chance was built at Anshun. I haven't heard that kind of language in a committee room since the Kharkov independency crisis."
"All the more reason she'll tell everyone to go to hell," Ramon grumbled.
He directed a wistful look at one of the waiters carrying around silver trays full of canapes, then checked around guiltily for Justine.
"She'll want her pound of flesh for that slight."
"Chairwoman Gall is a fellow professional," Thompson said. "The economic benefits for her fiefdom cannot be overlooked in these circumstances. She'll sign on the dotted line."
"She might," Ramon said. "But in any case, don't be so sure the High Angel will permit you to establish the agency there.
From what I understand, the High Angel is equally interested in the Dyson pair," Patricia said. "Besides, we don't actually need its permission to site the new agency facilities there. It's a convenient dormitory, nothing more."
"Any lack of cooperation on its part would be a problem," Ramon said.
"One we could surmount," Thompson said.
The primary reason for citing the agency there is simply moving it away from Anshun. As one, they turned to look at Campbell Sheldon, who was talking with Isabella. The girl was dressed in little more than a white cotton cobweb, whose active semi-organic fibers shifted every time she moved, so that her body's true sexuality remained provocatively veiled. She was laughing with easy enthusiasm at whatever story Campbell was recounting, while he seemed equally enthusiastic at the attention she was shining on him. "The Sheldons can be reasonable," Crispin said, "when it's in their interest."
"This whole agency project is in their favor," Thompson said.
"Crispin, much as I hate to interrupt a fellow guest when he's clearly having such a good time, but do you think you could broach the subject of the High Angel base to Campbell? It would sound better coming from someone with your authority."
"Oh, bloody hell," Crispin grumbled. He downed his sparkling gin.
"Why do I come to these weekends?"
Thompson, Patricia, and Ramon watched him walk across the room to the corner beyond the piano, where Campbell and Isabella were having their very public tête-à-tête. He stopped a waiter and grabbed a glass of black velvet before breaking in. Isabella welcomed the senator with a fast flutter of her eyelashes.
"A lovely girl," Ramon said. "You're very lucky."
"I know," Patricia said, "but I'm old and boring, so I don't suppose I'll have her for long. Once the novelty of being so close to the future president wears off, she'll move on. I did when I was that age."
"I don't even remember being that age anymore," Thompson said, "and not from erasing the memories, either. They just fade after so much time."
"To forgotten youth," Patricia said, and raised her glass. "May we always be reminded by envying those who have it."
"Amen."
Ramon touched his glass to hers, then with Thompson. They all drank the toast.
"If you are right about Chairwoman Gall being reluctant," Thompson said to Ramon, "may we presume upon you to broach that subject with her?"
"I'd sooner put my cock in a food processor and switch it to puree."
"You were married to my sister. How difficult can this be?"
Ramon put his head back and laughed.
"Ah, I'd forgotten what this family was like."
He clicked his fingers at a waiter, who hurried over with some canapes.
"All right. I might stop by at High Angel after this weekend. But I'm still not convinced that this agency is in the full interests of the African Caucus."
Thompson's good humor never faltered. "Then I'm sure we'll manage to find something that will convince you before you leave." They went through to the main dining room for the evening meal. Justine had arranged the seating as best she could, given the state of play so far. Not that she expected much maneuvering during the meal, but the options were open. This time she wound up next to Campbell, though she frowned when she saw Isabella seating herself beside Ramon, who appeared more than happy with the arrangement. Isabella had taken Gerhardt's seat, leaving the DRNG senator to sit next to Patricia, who Justine had wanted to place with Raphael. The Halgarths had done remarkably little in the way of negotiation so far. She knew Larry had talked to her father that morning, offering provisional support for the agency, but that was all. No doubt their cards would be on the table by tomorrow.
Text rolled down her virtual vision.
"Your ex is being a pain," Thompson sent.
"Don't make it so personal," she shot back.
"What does he want?"
"I've no idea. I thought we'd got him with the High Angel Assembly Platform contracts. Now he's seen how everyone is lining up behind the agency, he's angling for more.
I always knew he'd make a good politician one day. You and Gore never believed me. We're playing our hand too openly. It leaves us vulnerable to those we need to ally."
"You'll have to bring him back in."
"I'll do what I can, but I'm more concerned about the Halgarths."
"They're solid."
"Care to bet on that?"
When the meal was over and the party had broken up, Gore went back to the study. With his latest retro-sequenced modifications, he needed at most 3 hours out of every 24 to sleep, and often managed on a lot less. As he prowled along the ceiling-high bookshelves, he smelled the others as they went back to the lodges in the garden.
Isabella, with her residual sense of the many men who, for one reason or another, had brushed up close against her that evening, herself redolent with the delicate smell of lily and orchid from the daubs of perfume on her neck. Her aroma stretched thin as she hurried across the grass, avoiding the paths, moving away from Patricia's metallic tang. Ramon D.B.'s mélange of cologne and alcohol-laced perspiration awaited her, the two merging together as his lodge door closed behind her. Their combined odor built up heavily within the tight confines of the master bedroom. Saliva pheromones and the sugar-acid whiff of champagne mingled with it. Behind Gore's impassive gold face there was a stirring of amusement, as the hot stench of sex began to gush out from their bodies, while in Patricia's bedroom there was only the overpowering smell of pine soap as she drew her bath. No alcohol, no bitter salts of disappointment prickling her skin. She was content. So Isabella was the go-between, the one who would bind Ramon back into the deal, making him the promises her mistress had pre-authorized to secure his vote. And of course, she had a passing resemblance to Justine. A seduction of both mind and body. Poor, lucky Ramon. Gore found the book he was looking for, seeing the leather spine behind the continual stream of sparkling scarlet information that enveloped his world. He reached out a hand swathed in glowing bands of silver and platinum, sliding The Art of Financial Warfare by James Barclay off the shelf. Not that he needed to read it. All the wisdom it contained now flowed freely among his thoughts and management routines, but the physical touch was a strange comfort. This book had been his Bible during his first life, and was still regarded as a classic text for anyone going into finance. He could probably do a good job updating it himself. For some reason, he always found himself searching it out when he was performing difficult placements, and this was one of the most complex. The Starflight Agency had so many variables, many more than the usual political-economic ventures he was accustomed to. By rights, it ought not to work, or at best be another cash-starved government institution that limped along on poor performances and missed quotas. This was too grand for today's drab careerist politicians to make work. And yet, the people who would normally be tearing each other apart were actually cooperating and accommodating each other to facilitate its inception. What am I missing? Every formidable instinct he possessed was singing through his brain that something was wrong. He would have loved to believe that the human race was worthy and mature enough to behave so splendidly, to see a problem and address it with logic and resolution. There had been progress along the social evolutionary scale, he was the first to admit. Thanks to Rejuve, people did take the long-term view very seriously indeed nowadays. The Starflight Agency was a perfect example of that. So maybe I am the anachronism. Untrustworthy, suspicious, always looking for the worst in people. The barbarian who had no need to invade the city, for he had watched it grow up around him. He still wouldn't believe the agency could be birthed so easily. Unless the manipulators themselves are being manipulated. That notion was even harder to accept. He had been on this right from the start, watching with his usual Olympian detachment as Justine caught the implications from her own contacts and convened this weekend. As the most cursory reading of Barclay showed, to manipulate this situation earlier than he had, you would have to know the outcome of the Dyson mission before it was launched. Nobody possessed that kind of knowledge. With a dismissive sigh, he replaced the book and went to sit in front of the small pile of embers that the fire had reduced to. If Isabella's sweet body and wicked promises didn't do the trick, he would need to outflank Ramon D.B. by mid-morning tomorrow. Names flared within his private data casement. Contacts within the African caucus who would not take kindly to their leading senator turning down the subcontracts that reciting the agency at High Angel would bring to their worlds. He sniffed the air, infusing the bouquet of Justine and Campbell and clean cotton sheets in mellow combination. Now that would be an advantageous union, given what was expected to unfold over the next few years. Virtual hands reached out,
purchasing shares in companies around the peripheries of where the larger Starflight Agency contracts would fall amid the African Caucasus planets. Preparing the family. Strengthening the family.
"I have to tell you," Campbell said, "Nigel isn't happy about moving the Starship assembly platforms to High Angel."
Justine stroked his nose in reply, moving her finger down to his lips so he could kiss the tip. She was lying directly on top of him, with the duvet flung somewhere on the floor. The ancient logs of the cabin were thick enough to retain the bedroom's warmth against the chilly night outside. She didn't need covering just yet. Candles in bulbous glass bowls flickered in various alcoves, filling the air with a musky scent of lavender and sandalwood.
"Poor Nigel," she said with a pout, then smiled happily as his arms tightened around her. One hand was sliding sensually down her spine toward her rump. "What's his problem?"
"He gave clearance for everything that's been agreed so far, but moving to High Angel will delay the project by several months, and that includes the new scout mission. He won't shift on that."
"What about the ground defense segments of the Navy? Do you mind losing out on them?"
"We don't envisage losing out, exactly. We're doing what your family is doing and positioning ourselves. The primary contracts will be handled by the DRNG, but we'll still come out ahead. Augusta is the largest of the Big 15. Everything is proportional."
She looked around to find the bottle of Dom Pérignon, vintage 2331, was empty and neck down in the ice bucket at the side of the bed. A quick order to the house array sent a maid bot hurrying to bring another. "It's going to be interesting to see the New York Market Board on Monday morning. This weekend is going to see so many stock acquisitions and movements, the traders are going to know something's up."
"Yeah, we can't hold off introducing the agency for much longer."
He looked up as the maid bot slid toward the bed. "Ah, more?"
"Yes, please."
He moved his head back to find her grinning devilishly at him.
"My God. Remind me never to be around the week after you leave Rejuve. I doubt any man could survive that."
The delicious memory of those few days spent in a glade on the side of Mount Herculaneum came back to provoke a warm tingle of satisfaction inside her. "One dead," she murmured contentedly. Campbell lifted the cold bottle from the maid bot's grip.
"Shall I open it?"
"Afterward.
What about the High Angel problem?"
"We'll find a fix in the morning."
There was no specific time arranged for breakfast on Sunday morning. The guests arrived as they woke, drifting in across the lawns. For once the day had started without any clouds. Strong sunlight cast the estate's exuberant vegetation in a pleasant aspect. There were even a couple of red squirrels bounding about over the lawn. Justine sat with Campbell, relishing the tired but happy feeling that was soaking her body. Thompson had said a polite good morning when he came in, although his tone told her he was quite aware of what she'd been up to during the night. Not quite disapproving, but close. She and Campbell shared a secretive grin as her brother walked away. The grins reinforced each other, threatening to become the kind of unstoppable giggles that afflicted school kids.
"May I join you?" Ramon said.
"Please do,"
Justine said. There was no sign of Isabella. Nor Patricia, she realized. One of the house staff brought Ramon a pot of fresh English breakfast tea. Justine remembered introducing him to that drink. She always found it the best way to start the day. Coffee was too abrupt for her.
"I may have an idea that would smooth the way to move the agency to High Angel," Ramon said.
Justine and Campbell exchanged a brief look. Everyone was remarkably well briefed this morning, she thought. It was barely 30 minutes since she'd updated Gore.
"We'd certainly appreciate anything which could help," Campbell said. "Parallel development. You continue building the first 5 scout ships at the Anshun facility, while the High Angel shipyards are being put together. That would provide the whole agency concept with the kind of positive outlook which the African Caucasus can support."
Campbell was surprised by the notion.
"I suppose that would work. There certainly wouldn't be any of the delays which we're resistant to, but it would also incur much greater startup costs than we envisaged.
You should speak with Patricia.
but I think you'll find Doy's team is open to raising the budget to accommodate us." Justine waited until they'd all finished eating before cornering Ramon as he walked back to his cabin. "What did she offer you to achieve that little strategic alignment?"
"Who?"
"Patricia." She so nearly said Isabella. "The original agreement was that Buta supplies the new High Angel shipyards. It is a logical extension for the construction companies to be awarded the support contracts as well."
"Smart move," Gore said later. "Support contracts can ultimately be worth more than the construction in the long term. Which I guess is what we're looking at here."
"I'd love to know which one of them suggested it," Justine said.
"Me too. I'm becoming concerned by just how much money Doy is prepared to sign over. I'm not denying it will be good for us, but it shows a degree of desperation I hadn't expected from her."
"I'm not surprised at all," Justine said. "She's using this to buy herself the election, and it's all paid for by tax money. She's a politician. What did you expect?"
"More subtlety. The senators will know what's happened here, even if the electorate doesn't care. If it turns out the Dyson aliens are no threat, then the amount of money she's offered the Starflight Agency is excessive, and they'll react to that. It's not like a politician to support something so radical, so wholeheartedly. They safeguard their own careers before anything. But you're the one that claims the Dysons will prove hostile and will need to evolve the agency into a navy."
"I know. But I'm not standing for election. There's a small part of me that's tempted to sink this whole venture here and now."
"What? You have to be joking."
"Don't worry, I won't. But something's not right."
"Care to be more specific?"
"I can't. I've analyzed this all night, compared it to a dozen similar guiding weekends this family has been involved with. There's nothing tangible except my gut feeling."
"You're just worried about what the Halgarths will pull. They've been biding their time, ready for this moment when the rest of us have reached a broad agreement. Then they'll make their bid."
"Maybe you're right. I hope so."
Justine got the opportunity to find out soon enough. There was a general progress review meeting scheduled for mid-morning. They held it in the library. It was Larry who requested it to be limited to those who held Level 1 Commonwealth Security clearance. That meant Justine herself only just scraped in, due to her directorship of several companies that supplied equipment to directorates that avoided the public view. But it certainly excluded everybody's partners and aides, along with Isabella. There was a short, sharp argument at the door when she was turned away. Patricia came in looking slightly flustered. Everyone inside had heard what the girl had shouted.
"Sorry about that," Patricia said as she sat at the table.
Justine stifled her own smirk, seeing quite a few others doing the same. As soon as the doors were closed, Thompson stood up.
"I expect this to be the final session for this weekend. We all seem to be in broad agreement over the principal structure which the agency will follow. This gives us a chance to iron out any final problems. I'm sure none of us want any showstoppers at this stage. I, for one, have a number of Senate votes to attend on Monday, and I'd appreciate getting to them."
He sat down beside Gore, whose polished gold face turned expectantly to Justine.
"The major development this weekend seems to be moving the agency's primary base to High Angel, given that we're foreseeing that it, or possibly a navy, will be in operational status for a long time. It does make sense and certainly has our family's approval. Does anyone disagree?"
"As you said, Justine, we're all in broad agreement with what's been negotiated this weekend," Larry Halgarth said. "The High Angel move, the preliminary work for Navy defenses, my family will certainly add its rubber stamp to all this."
"Here it comes," Campbell murmured to Justine.
"However, there is one facet to all this planning which has been overlooked."
"What's that?" Gore asked sharply.
"Giving the Navy an offensive capability. If, God forbid, the Dysons do turn out to be hostile, simply sitting underneath force field domes and hoping they'll go away isn't realistic. We would have to carry the fight into their territory."
"Just hold on a minute here," Gerhardt said. "Since when have we included invasion in our hostile encounter scenarios?"
All my briefings have concentrated on possible clashes over colonizing new stars in the direction of the Dyson pair. In other words, it's all going to be down to agreeing on the direction and limits of expansion. And that's assuming they do want to expand.
They filled an entire solar system, Larry said. Their culture is just as expansion-based as ours, if not more so. Make no mistake about it. The two of us will meet out there in space.
They're 700 light-years away, Ramon said, and it's a big galaxy. Defensive capability is only going to be a sop to public opinion anyway. At least that was my understanding.
That's very comforting. But what if we really need it?
Why? Campbell asked.
Excuse me?
Ramon was right in saying that any future clash with them will be over establishing borders to our respective spheres of colonization. Any navy we create will be a long-term venture. I doubt we'll need it within a century. There isn't exactly a rush to fill up Phase 3 space like there was with 1 and 2, more's the pity. Even if they expand at our rate, we'd be in Phase 5 or 6 space before the possibility of clashes arose.
And if they don't stick to your timetable?
Then we stop at Phase 5 space in that sector and continue outward everywhere else. Like Ramon said, it's a big galaxy.
Somebody was so concerned about them, they tried to quarantine them off from this big galaxy, and we've seen for ourselves how aggressive they are. That tells me we have to prepare for trouble.
Campbell regarded him as a teacher would a particularly awkward pupil.
What do you think they'll invade us for, exactly?
If they want mineral or chemical resources, they can get them from any star system. Energy? Their fusion systems look more advanced than ours. There's no economic or logical reason for them to invade us, especially not with a navy in place. It's a deterrent.
Fine. Then make it a working deterrent. Give it some teeth.
What sort of teeth would you like it to have? Justine asked. I take it this is why you wanted everyone here to be security cleared.
Yes. Larry nodded at Natasha cursely.
My directorate has been reviewing the data which the Second Chance came back with, she said. You were right to say their fusion systems are more advanced than ours. So are their force fields. If Captain Keim hadn't pulled back, we estimate that the Second Chance would have been destroyed within a minute of their missiles reaching attack range. The only thing that saved them was the FTL capability. If we are going to confront the Dyson aliens in the future, even if it is solely to establish boundaries, we will need a lot more firepower than we've carried so far.
Then we'll scale things up for the next generation of ships, Campbell said. Increase the force field strength.
Provide more power to the atom lasers and plasma lances. They will do the same, Natasha said flatly, and their shipbuilding capacity is much greater than ours will be for the foreseeable future. Their entire civilization is based around spaceflight and manufacturing ships. We cannot win a contest to scale things up. What we need to do is take this to the next level and develop a new generation of advanced weapons. Such as? Gore asked. The theoretical concepts which my directorate studies are need to know only.
It wouldn't hurt to examine the idea, Thompson said. What my family would like to see is Natasha's directorate transferred to the Starflight Agency's defense office, Larry said.
He looked at Patricia.
That will require an executive order.
I can probably arrange one, she said.
It would need to be integrated with the rest of the Commonwealth's security arrangements, Raphael Columbia said.
The rest of them? Patricia repeated warily.
If the Navy is to have an effective defensive role, then the current Commonwealth Security Directorate should be brought together to perform the service. The Special Sciences Supervisory Directorate and the Internal Security Directorate could be combined under the aegis of my own directorate.
Isn't that a little drastic? Justine asked. Not to mention alarmist. What relevance is the Serious Crimes Directorate to all this?
We're the ones already fighting this conflict, Raphael said. It is my directorate which is tracking down the terrorists who attacked the Second Chance. That act amounts to anti-human treachery as far as I'm concerned.
Justine sat back in astonishment.
Talk about gung-ho. Let him have it,
her father sent to her. It's just paper empire building, and the agency's planetary defense office has to start with something. I would point out that as Raphael's directorate operates on a quasi-secret basis anyway, Larry said, the preparatory functions it will be conducting into strategic planetary defense can quite easily be kept quiet under its standard procedures. I believe that was the original recommendation of the Exoprotectorate Council.
It was, Campbell said. For a moment, the two of them locked gazes. Then Campbell offered up a small smile.
Well, I have no objections to that. In fact, it's rather tidy having everything under one roof. Think you can cope with the extra responsibility, Raphael?
And the budget, Gore grunted.
Everyone laughed.
You can depend on me, Raphael assured them.
It makes sense, Gore said to Justine and Thompson after everyone else had left. And it was a brilliant piece of maneuvering on the Halgarth's part. Nobody was going to say no that late in the day. Larry effectively split the Navy. The Sheldons will have the ships, while the defense side will all be under Raphael's control. He's got the budget strings, which puts the DRNG and Buta subordinate to him. And defense will ultimately be the bigger budget, Thompson said. We should have seen that coming. The Halgarths keep their dominance of the force field market.
The defense budget will only be bigger if the Dysons are a threat, Justine observed. I seem to be the only one who isn't convinced they will be.
You two certainly are, and as for Raphael, Jesus, it won't be long before he's designing uniforms with nice shiny jackboots.
Who'd blame him? All the girls love a sailor.
It's not funny, Dad. This merger gives him a great deal of power. The directorates were kept separate for a reason.
I'll talk to Patricia and Doy herself when I get back to the Senate tomorrow, Thompson said. You're right about that, Justine.
There needs to be an executive review committee for Raphael's new empire, and his new vice directors will be appointed from other families and dynasties. I've got some contacts on the inside of the directorate who can keep an eye on him as well.
Don't worry. We'll keep him in check. Even with his tight-fitting goggles and fur-lined woolen balaclava, Ozzy could feel the freezing wind biting his cheeks. It was infiltrating the edge of his hood as he moved his arms back and forth in a smooth rhythm to propel himself forward with the carved bone ski poles gripped in each hand. The repetitive motion was hard work. He'd only been outside 15 minutes, and already perspiration was soaking into the T-shirt he wore under his checked shirt, sweaters, and ice whale fur overcoat. His skis bobbed over the crisp ice, leaving clear twin tracks behind. Out here, on the relatively level surface of the vast depression surrounding the ice citadel, he could move with a degree of ease, though it was nothing like the speed he used to reach on resort slopes back in the Commonwealth. It would be a lot slower in the forest, he knew, and he'd be hauling a great deal more weight with his backpack as well. Today he was practicing with about half the weight of what he would be taking when they left for good. He twisted his body carefully, curving to a halt before jamming his poles into the thin layer of crusty ice. Red sunlight washed down on the desolate landscape, revealing a multitude of small ripples in the frozen ground. At half a mile behind him, the ice citadel stood aloof from the flat gray land, green light winking steadily from its pinnacle, prickles of crimson sunlight scattered off facets in its hexagonal crystal mirrors. 100 yards away, Tochi was sliding along efficiently. They'd started calling the alien that now, rather than the Tochi. Communication personalized it, at least from the human perspective. Ozzy figured he owed it that much. It had taken Ozzy and George Parkin a week to design the vehicle that carried the heavy alien. The main structure was a simple sledge of carved ice whale bone, over 4 yards long, which could hold Tochi's entire body with room to spare. At the front was a windscreen of crystal cut from a tree, and secured in a bone frame that angled back. Behind that, stitched to the circular hoops that went over the sledge platform, was a cylinder of ice whale fur that laced up at the rear. The arrangement was the equivalent of a fur coat for Tochi, keeping its body insulated from the subarctic air and its ridges of locomotion flesh well clear of the ground. To move the sledge along,
A pair of spiked poles were fixed to the framework on either side in a variant of a rowlock. George Parkin had designed, carved, and assembled the four sturdy little mechanisms himself, and was quietly proud of his achievement. All four spiked poles passed through leather rings in the fur cylinder, which allowed them a fair degree of movement. Tochi gripped the ends in its manipulator flesh, and used the poles as combination ski poles and oars. A big crowd had gathered outside the ice citadel the first time Ozzy, Orion, and George had pushed the sledge out from the workshop. It had taken Tochi a couple of minutes of tentative experimental motions before mastering the poles. Since then, the three of them had been out every day, practicing. Ozzy watched Tochi maneuver the sledge toward where he was waiting without losing any momentum. The contraption made him think of some bizarre Victorian attempt to build a snowmobile. But it worked, and the alien was proficient enough now to give him a great deal of confidence for their venture. That just left Orion. The boy was skijoring behind Tochi, short skis strapped to his boots, and holding on to a slim rope that was tied to the back of the sledge frame. Ozzy had decided it was a lot easier for Orion to do that than learn how to ski properly. In fact, the boy was probably enjoying himself a little too much as he swayed from side to side behind the sledge. Ozzy wondered if he should insist on a shorter rope, take away the opportunity for delight. Although Orion was a lot happier these days, now their preparations to leave were becoming ever more tangible. The sledge came to a slow stop beside Ozzy, all four poles digging into the gritty ice to score narrow furrows. He was pleased to see Orion angling his own skis correctly to break. More than once the boy had ploughed into the back of Tochi's sledge. Maybe they did stand a chance after all. Ozzy held out a mitten, thumb extended upward. Behind the thick windscreen of crystal, Tochi's manipulator flesh formed a similar gesture. "How you doing?" Ozzy asked loudly. It was too cold to pull his balaclava aside and expose his mouth. "All right," Orion yelled back. "My arms still ache a bit from yesterday, but these skis are easier to balance on." "Okay, let's keep going." Ozzy struck off across the ice, heading toward a section of the crystal tree forest he'd visited on a harvesting trip 3 weeks ago. He held a steady pace, concentrating on the ground ahead. There were hidden ridges and little jutting pinnacles of rock that could prove perilous if he hit them wrong. And if Tochi ran over any of them, it would be a plain disaster. He wondered if they should take some spare ice whale bone and a few tools for repairs, just in case. It would mean more weight, but increase their chances. Like everything they carried with them, there had to be a balance between safety and success. When they started their trial runs in the forest, he'd have a better idea.
"Ozzy!"
He turned at the muffled voice, finding Tochi was laboring hard with the sledge's poles, moving them fast, gradually catching up. Orion was shouting furiously, his free arm waving about. Ozzy moved his legs proficiently, bending from the knees as he slewed around, and quickly came to a halt. He stared out over the empty floor of the ice citadel depression to where the boy was pointing. The Sylphon had finally arrived to hunt. A great procession of them was emerging from the forest on the other side of the depression. From such a distance, they were little more than a moving grey line, although dainty lights sparkled along its length. When he used his retinal inserts to zoom in, he saw the actuality. There were over 100 of the biped aliens already in the open, with 24 at the front riding on some quadruped animals that moved as fast as horses, even in the terrible cold of this world. Those on foot jogged along effortlessly despite the thick coats they were wearing. Half of them were carrying lanterns on long poles that danced about as they moved. After so long spent in the ice citadel with its uneventful, repetitive days, the thrill Ozzy felt at the sight of them was so intense it surprised him. For months he'd been so resolutely dispassionate, he'd almost forgotten that he could experience emotions this strong. "We're on our way out of here." "Let's get back," he shouted at Orion. He made a quick hand signal to Tochi, indicating the ice citadel. The alien mimicked another thumbs up behind the windscreen. They made good time back to the ice citadel. The inhabitants had all turned out for the arrival of the Sylphon, milling around on the ice outside. Ozzy grabbed a couple of humans and built a Korokai,
to help push Tochi's sledge over the last 16 yards around the base of the big building, where boots and hooves had churned the ice and sandy soil to a sluggish shingle. When the sledge's fur covering had been unlaced, the big alien quickly slithered down into the warmer, lower level. Ozzy put his skis into the rack and went back outside. There must have been 250 sylphon in the hunt. Their singing and trilling floated across the icy ground, reaching the ice citadel long before they did. Even in this bleak, perpetual winter, the sound was uplifting, a reminder that beyond the forest, there were worlds visited by summer. The riders cantered up on steeds that had bodies like fat horses, with necks that extended out horizontally, ending in arrow-shaped heads. Their hide was like tawny snakeskin, with a wispy feather rising from every scale. Ozzy was sure he could see slim gills opening and closing quickly along the length of their necks, amid the rippling muscle, as the riders reined them in just before they reached the excited crowd. He also cast an eye over the long, silver spears fastened behind the low saddles. They seemed very impractical, especially for a rider. The mounted sylphon were warbling away in their own tongue as they looked down on the crowd. They wore long coats of fluffy swan-white fur, with hoods that tapered away down their backs. Gloves and boots were made from the same pelt, which made Ozzy wonder what animal it had come from. He suspected it would look rather spectacular. Sarah stepped forward and bowed slightly before the lead rider, then spoke in their own language. "Welcome back. We are always pleased to see you and your brethren." The lead rider twittered away in reply, "Dearest Sarah, happiness flies with the kiss that fruits among us. Joy we know at the seeing of you and your life full people. Cold this world is. Strong you must be to thrive below its red light. Strong you are, for thrive you do amid the deep ice and the high sky. Your citadel is a fine home for us in this cold wilderness. Will you be staying here tonight? Time among this home long past is what we will reap this day. If we can help, then please just tell us. Are you hunting the ice whales this time? Out there they are, covered in their white deeps. Fast they move in short moments. Big they grow in long years, loud they call. Far away amid the uncountable stars we hear their refrain. We challenge, we chase, and in the end we share our blood to know such a life we gladly live. We would like to follow. We would like to have the ice whale bodies afterward. The rider dismounted in a quick lithe leap to stand in front of Sarah. He pushed his hood back and looked down at her well-covered face as if perplexed. When all is done and life has lost its body, what happens then to that which is left dead matters not. Thank you. Sarah bowed again. The riders led their animals into the unused stable halls, while the sylphon on foot went straight inside, singing and laughing as they descended the broad spiral passage to the central chamber. It was a gushing invasion of light and good humor, and the smell of springtime and cozy fireside warmth, transforming the ancient citadel to the kind of haven from the cold and desolation outside that its builders must surely have intended right from the start. When Ozzy finally got down to the main chamber, the lantern poles had all been slotted into holes in the wall, so they overhung the floor, their thick gold radiance holding back the oppressive red sunlight, banishing the grime, fouling the carvings. The sylphon had shed their white coats, bringing the tangible taste of a temperate forest to the harsh stone universe of the cavern with their leaf-green toga cloaks. They opened their packs to hand around flasks and clusters of berries and little biscuity circular cakes. It was the carefree party gathering that made Ozzy ache for his earlier life and the simple pleasures it contained. To his horror and disgust, he found his eyes filling with moisture at the memories that the sight triggered. Most of the humans and other alien residents stood around the walls, watching their visitors in simple contentment. Orion was down there on the floor in the thick of things, moving from one sylphon to another to be sung at and admired and given morsels of food and sips from the flasks. A wondrous smile lifted his young face as his friendship pendant blazed with turquoise starlight. "Quite something, isn't it?" Sarah said quietly in Ozzy's ear. "I'd forgotten what they were like," he admitted. "Christ, I'd forgotten what anything outside this gulag is like."
A slight frown deepened the heavy wrinkles on her face.
You're going, then?
Oh, yeah.
George could use some help first.
What?
He made an effort to turn away from the exultant Sylphon.
We have to get the big sleds ready. We need those ice whales, Ozzy. People will die without them.
Yeah, he said reluctantly, knowing she was right. Too many people were depending on the hunt and its bounty.
All right. I'll go help George. He glanced back across the cavern. But do me a favor. Don't ask Orion.
I won't.
Ozzy was just one of 40 people who George and Sarah had marshaled into the preparations for tomorrow. Even so, it took the rest of the afternoon to load the big covered sleds ready to follow the hunt. There were the triple-layer tents and the cooking gear and fuel oil to be transferred into bladders, the butchery kits, the barrels and cauldrons. Then George and the more proficient bone carpenters made some last-minute repairs and patches. More people were readying the Ibnan in the stables. He felt tired but quietly pleased when he finished up and made his way back down to his rooms. Orion was still with the Sylphon, but Ozzy insisted he leave them. Tochi was already in their sleeping room when they arrived. Ozzy shifted his retinal inserts to ultraviolet. Ragged patterns were flashing within Tochi's front eye segment, question upon question about the Sylphon. Ozzy made calming gestures with his arms and picked up a much-washed parchment of cured hide. He used a charcoal stump to write.
Yes, they are the aliens who made the paths.
Tomorrow they will hunt the big fur creatures. After that, we follow them off this world.
What is it saying?
Orion asked excitedly, as Ozzy held the parchment up in front of Tochi.
It's really happy they're here and we've got our chance, Ozzy told him.
Orion snatched the parchment from Ozzy and wiped the charcoal letters away into a broad grey smudge. Then he wrote,
It's great news, isn't it? We're leaving.
Tochi took its own parchment off the small pile, its manipulator flesh closed around a charcoal stump.
Together we will do this. Together the three of us will be a triumph.
Orion stood in front of Tochi and raised both hands in a double thumbs up. The alien's manipulator flesh closed around the boy's fingers.
Okay, you dudes, Ozzy said. Let's get serious.
We've only got one chance at this, so it's got to be right. Orion, open the security mesh up and get all your stuff packed away. If it isn't in your rucksack, it's staying here. Then get your best outdoor clothes ready for the morning. When you've done that, pop out to the kitchen range and fill all our thermos flasks with boiling water. We're going to make up some of that powdered juice, the stuff with extra glucose and crap in it. We'll drink that outside tomorrow.
Can't I do that in the morning?
There's no telling when the Sylphon are going to leave. Everyone says it's always early, so we can't gamble that there's like going to be hot water ready for us tomorrow. This has all got to be done now. We'll have about 15 minutes warning, man. I fixed it with George for us to have places on one of the big covered sleds.
All right, then, Orion said. I'll get started.
Ozzy wrote more lines on his parchment, telling Tochi to get the best meal it could tonight.
Don't forget me. The alien wrote back. Don't leave me behind.
We won't. Ozzy dug out some self-heating packages of Cumberland sausages and mash in onion gravy, which fizzed away while he prepared his own kit. Even piling the tent and various other essentials in bags on the back of Tochi's sledge, and himself and Orion both skiing with their rucksacks, they'd never be able to take everything they'd brought with them on the Lontrus. It was time for hard choices and educated guesses. He decided to leave most of his clothes behind. He was wearing enough to survive on this planet, which gave him enough to live anywhere, just not in any great variety. There was packaged food for 15 days, which he included in the bundle to go on Tochi's sledge, though luxuries like chocolates and biscuits and tea he would leave for Sarah and George. The medical kit was also a must. His set of ceramic Teflon-coated cooking pans was dumped, as was the small kerosene stove. All the riding gear, the saddle, the pack harnesses from the Lontrus, it was all useless to him now. He looked at the sorely depleted pile of things he wanted to keep, knowing it was still too big.
We can leave the security mesh,
Orion said when he came back in with the flasks. That must weigh a bit.
Yeah, Ozzy said slowly. Guess so. Good thinking there, man.
The boy picked up his backpack, holding it above his head as he gave a goofy grin. His red hair hadn't been cut since they'd arrived at the Ice Citadel, so that it now came down almost to his shoulders and threatened to cover his eyes most of the time.
And I can carry a lot more for you. See, I've got almost nothing in here.
He tried holding his ancient nylon rucksack aloft with one hand to prove his point.
That's okay, man, Ozzy said as the backpack tipped over and Orion made a comical lurch to catch it.
We've got everything we need to make it out of here. Anything more and we'd be jeopardizing our chances. No way am I doing that again. Did I ever tell you how totally crap our spacesuit was when Nigel stepped out on Mars?
Don't think so.
Now that was being unprepared in the most serious fashion. Jesus, it was a miracle he ever came back, and he was only a couple of yards from the wormhole the whole time.
That would have been fucking impressive, wouldn't it? First person to step through our new machine, and he drops down dead from the lack of a bicycle puncture repair kit.
History would have been a hell of a lot different.
What was it like? Mars.
Cold. Colder than this dump. And dead. I mean, really seriously dead. Believe me, you know when somewhere has been dead for a billion years before the dinosaurs were killed off. You just had to look at it and you knew. He shook his head, surprised by how strong the image was after nearly 3.5 centuries. So now, show me what you've put in the pack.
Tochi returned with the bucket it ate its mashed crystal tree fruit from. Ozzy and Orion settled down on their cots with their packaged meals, and the three of them ate in silence. The Sylphan out in the central chamber was singing away blithely, clearly intent on partying the night away like a bunch of boisterous students. Ozzy caught the occasional line of verse, most of which praised the ice whales for their size and speed and ferocity. Sarah was their first visitor. Ozzy handed over the items he was leaving behind, which she accepted with brisk thanks. George turned up with the sledmasters who would captain the hunting party. The other 5 people who were going to try to find a path off the planet wandered in, 4 men and 1 woman. They sat on the cots and everyone started discussing options and strategies. The modest rock cavern took on the kind of hyped-up atmosphere in the team changing room minutes before the big match. Thinking that, Ozzy briefly wondered who had won the Commonwealth Cup. It amazed him. He even managed to fall asleep. But there he was, tangled up in an unsealed sleeping bag, his arms and neck chilly as Orion shook him awake. The rug hadn't even been pulled over the bright crystal duct in the ceiling.
It's time, Ozzy, the boy said in a near fearful voice. George says they're getting ready.
Right then, man, let's get to it. Ozzy felt like singing, something uplifting, like the early Beatles or the puppet presidents. Out in the central chamber, the Sylphan had quietened down. He pulled the rings on the self-heating breakfast packets and started to get dressed. Full-body thermal underwear, of course, then a thick sweatshirt and his cord trousers, a clean, checked shirt. By the time he'd laced his hiking boots up, he was starting to feel warm, so he carried the rest, the 2 sweaters, waterproofed and insulated trousers, scarf, balaclava, gloves, earmuffs, goggles, and of course the ice whale fur coat, over trousers and mittens. He checked Orion, who was equally well-dressed. Half of his garments were Ozzy's, cut down weeks ago and sewn carefully to fit, in readiness for this occasion. They ate their breakfast, took a last visit to the bathroom, then collected Tochi from its quarters. When they got upstairs, the big workshop was abuzz with activity. Sylphan riders were already leading their animals from the stables. George was rapping out orders to his teams. Tochi shifted about uncomfortably on the cold, damp stone floor, while Ozzy and Orion gave its sledge a final check. Then it quickly slithered up into the protective cylinder of ice whale fur. Ozzy handed Tochi 3 heat bricks before carefully lacing up the flaps of fur at the back, making sure there were no gaps. He and Orion piled their packs on the little space left over at the rear of the sledge platform. Tochi was now going to have to stay inside until they reached a warmer world. Weeks ago, Ozzy had tried asking if Tochi got claustrophobia, but either their pictures and words vocabulary hadn't developed enough to explain the concept, or the alien didn't have a psychology susceptible to such things.
It was George himself who helped Ozzy and Orion push Tochi's sledge outside into the weak, pre-dawn light. Then they tied it to one of the big covered sleds pulled by a team of 5 Ibnan. After exchanging okay and good luck signs with the alien, they clambered inside amid all the equipment for butchering and cooking the ice whales. Bill the Korokai was their driver, and Sarah wedged herself inside beside them, along with 15 others. The small brazier hanging from the top of the sled was lit, casting a murky brimstone light around the inside, complete with noxious fumes. The side flap was closed. As the red sun slowly rose above the horizon, the Sylphon gathered together outside the ice citadel, their white furs gleaming bright in the glow from their lanterns, spears and bows held ready. They began a slow chant, their voices deeper than Ozzy had ever heard before. In a mournful baritone, they sounded a lot more alien and far more menacing. Their riders moved off at an easy canter, leaving those on foot to follow at a slower pace. The sleds pulled by the Ibnan lurched off in eager pursuit, with pans and metallic equipment clanking loudly. It took an hour and a half just to reach the border of the Crystal Tree Forest. So far, the covered sleds had kept up with the Sylphon on foot. But once they reached the small trees around the fringe, they had to arrange themselves in single file. The path between the steadfast trunks was narrow and awkward, slowing them further. They slowly lost distance on the Sylphon, although the track they left was easy enough to follow. Occasionally the Korokai drivers would catch a glimpse of the shimmering light from their lanterns through the snow-covered trunks. Several times, Ozzy went over to the door flap to check Tochi was still being towed. The sledge was slipping along without any trouble. Tochi was barely having to use the 4 poles to steer with. "How much longer?" Orion asked after they'd been pushing through the forest for over an hour. "We'll be in the forest for a couple of hours yet before we reach the hunting ground," Sarah said. "After that, who knows?" Their riders went on ahead to try and track some ice whales.
"How big is the hunting ground?"
"I have no idea. You can't see the far side no matter how clear the air is. Hundreds of miles across, I suppose. Once we had to turn back, we'd gone so far and they hadn't started hunting. But that is rare. If we're lucky, and there's some close by, they might even hunt this afternoon."
"Will they leave at night?" Ozzy asked.
"No, that is, they never have yet." It was another 2.25 hours before they reached the edge of the forest. Ozzy and Orion both peered through the flap, eager to see the land beyond. They were high up, something Ozzy hadn't appreciated before. The Crystal Tree Forest sprawled across the plateau of some broad massif. Where it ended, the ground swept down toward a vast plain dominated by hundreds of low volcanic craters. Sarah had been right about its size. The ultra-cold air was perfectly clear, yet from his vantage point half a mile above the plain, Ozzy couldn't see the other side. It was hidden within a hazy, crimson horizon. The crater rims themselves were almost flat, but between them the frozen land had ripped open, producing thousands of rocky fangs like small matterhorns. Crystal trees grew on their lower slopes, although the pinnacles were rugged, naked rock with a few streaks of snow and ice caught in crevices, reflecting a dusky scarlet in the pervasive sunlight. The craters were all filled with ice particles, Sarah told them, fine sand-like granules that produced a perfectly level surface, giving no clue how deep they actually were. Most of them had vapor rising from the center in small plumes that drifted almost straight upward, slowly getting wider and thinner as they climbed, until, thousands of feet above the plain, they merged into smears of tenuous cirrus that meandered about like spacious contrails. When Ozzy switched to infrared, he could see the craters glowing with a weak intensity, no more than a few degrees higher than the surrounding land, but a temperature difference sufficient to cause evaporation. He wondered how much warmer the craters were at the bottom. Halfway down the slope leading to the plain, he could see the Sylphon threading their way past small clumps of crystal trees, lantern lights bobbing about merrily. There was no sign of the riders. One by one, the big sleds crested the top of the slope and began their precarious descent after the hunters. It was a rough journey down with the rucked surface rocking the sleds about. Every so often, the Korokai drivers had to use the Ibnan to slow their speed rather than pull them along. Ozzy had a lot of difficulty looking out and checking on Tochi,
Everyone inside the covered sled was hanging on grimly to the broad bone cage. In the end, he just stayed put. There wasn't much he could do if the tow rope broke anyway. Several pieces of equipment had worked loose to roll around, pans and bone struts jangling as they banged painfully into shins and arms and chests. The brazier was swinging in an alarmingly wide arc on its short chain. They couldn't have taken more than 40 minutes to reach the plane, although time stretched out to hours inside the cramped, stinking cabin. Ozzy had never before appreciated how important it was to be able to see out of a moving vehicle. His imagination filled the whole route down with knife-blade boulders waiting to split them open, and the slope was bound to end with a 100-yard vertical cliff. Bill let out a low trumpet of satisfaction to signal the descent was over. Inside the sled, everyone flashed nervous grins around, not willing to admit just how scared they'd been. After that, progress was appreciably easier. Sarah was confident they could close some of the distance that had accumulated between them and the Sylphon. Orion kept his friendship pendant clasped tightly in his fist, watching its sparkling blue light intently. The covered sleds maintained a single file, following the fresh tracks in the crunchy grains of snow. They were heading directly away from the massif, rattling along at a good pace. By midday they were skirting along the shoreline ridge of the first crater, with a string of savage rock peaks on the other side. After that, there were gullies crowned by curving waves of compacted snow, looking as if the slightest tremble would send them avalanching into the gulf below. Ravines with frozen sheet ice along the floor, where the Ibnan had trouble getting a grip with their hooves. Spinneys and forests of crystal trees and bulbous bushes. Often, when he looked out, Ozzy would see great swaths of them smashed and shattered, leaving jagged stumps surrounded by a pile of ice-encrusted branches. There were narrow, steep saddle valleys to surmount, where their speed was reduced to a painful crawl on the ascent, only to degenerate into a mad slither downward, more abrupt and frightening than the trip down from the massif. Long curves around craters, where the vapor drifted out sideways like a mist, swiftly covering Ibnan and sleds alike in a crusty hoarfrost. When the sun was an hour and a half from the horizon, the massif was invisible behind them, blocked from view by towering spires of sharp black rock. Shadows were lengthening and darkening across the rust-tinted ground. The Ibnan teams on all the sleds were beginning to tire. Even on the flat, their speed was noticeably less than earlier. "There'll be no hunt today," Sarah said after she returned from a quick discussion with Bill, "and we need to set up the tents soon. It's difficult in the dark." After another half hour, they emerged from the gap between two rock ridges to look down on a crater measuring over 6 miles across. Sometime after the basin formed, the volcanic activity that riddled the area had thrown up yet another range of fierce crags. This one formed a long promontory, extending out almost halfway across the crater. The Sylphon had gathered at the foot of the peak closest to the rim, riders and those on foot bunched together and glowing like a multifaceted jewel in the gathering twilight. A stretch of forest grew up the slope beyond them, its crystal trees taller than those back on the forests of the massif, looking dark and forbidding in the vermilion gloaming. The sleds pulled up in a broad circle, half a mile from the Sylphon, on top of an escarpment that skirted the landward crags. Everyone jumped too, hauling the tents out and slotting the framework together. Once the big tents were up, Ozzy, Orion, and George rigged a smaller frame over Tochi's sledge and pulled a big sheet of fur over it. Inside that, they draped another blanket of fur across the top of the sledge's protective cylinder. "It should be okay in that," George said as he crawled out. Ozzy, who was left inside, grunted agreement. He lit a pair of candles and put them on the ground in front of the sledge's windscreen. There wasn't much space there, probably no more than a couple of cubic yards, but it allowed Tochi to look out, maybe take away any fear of entombment. Looking in through the pane of crystal, Ozzy could see the alien motionless behind it, front eye section aligned on him. He held a mitten out, thumb upward. Tochi's front eye swirled with ultraviolet patterns, slightly smudged by flaws in the crystal. It translated roughly into, "Don't forget me tomorrow." "Not a chance," Ozzy whispered inside his balaclava. Tochi pulled the tab on a heat brick.
Ozzy waited until he saw the brick start to glow a deep cherry red, then waved and backed out of the fur coverings. There was probably another 20 minutes before the sun sank below the horizon. Ozzy hurried off toward the crater rim. It was achingly quiet in the moments just before nightfall. Even the Sylphon's perpetual singing had ended out here under the somber glacial sky. Ahead of him, the surface of the granular ice that filled the crater basin was so flat that the illusion of liquid was almost perfect. As he approached it, he half expected to see ripples. He knelt down beside it and touched it with his mitten. The surface had the texture of thick oil, though the farther down he pushed his hand, the greater the resistance became.
"Careful you don't fall in," Sarah said.
Ozzy straightened up, shaking residual grains from his mitten.
"Man, you always make me feel like I'm doing something wrong."
"People have fallen in before. We don't risk our own lives trying to find them now. They never leave any trace. It's not as if there could be any bubbles."
"Yeah, figures. This stuff isn't natural. Grains of ice like this should stick together."
"Of course they should, but they're being constantly churned up and kept loose, like flour in a food mixer.
And the ice whales are doing the churning."
"Them and whatever else is down there. After all, they have to eat something.
Hopefully just iceweed, or whatever the plant life is at the bottom."
"You wouldn't say that if you'd ever seen one." She turned and began to walk up the slight incline. Ozzy started after her.
"Why not?"
"Let's just say they don't act like herbivores."
"You got it all figured out, don't you?"
"No, Ozzy, nothing like. I understand very little of this place. And all the others I walked through. Why don't the Sylphon allow us to have electricity?"
"Simple enough theory. They're experiencing life on a purely physical level. That's all these bodies we see are for, to give them a platform at this level of personal consciousness evolution. And it kills me to say it, but it's a pretty low level given their capabilities. You start introducing electricity and machines, and all the paraphernalia which goes with it, then you start to shrink that opportunity for raw, natural experience."
"Yeah," she said sourly. "God forbid they should invent medicine."
"It's irrelevant to them. We need it because we treasure our individuality and continuity. Their outlook is different. They're on a journey that has a very definite conclusion. At the end of their levels, they get to become a part of their adult community."
"How the hell do you know that?"
He shrugged, a gesture largely wasted under his heavy fur coat. "I was told that once."
"Who by?"
"This dude I met in a bar."
"Dear Christ, I don't know which is weirder, them or you."
"Definitely them."
They came to the top of the small rim as the sun vanished, leaving only a flaming fuchsia glow in the sky.
"You also shouldn't be out so late," Sarah said. "There's no beacon to guide you back here, you know."
"Don't worry about me. I see better in the dark than most people."
"You got fur instead of skin as well. Even the Korokai don't stay out at night on this world."
"Sure, sorry. Wasn't thinking." "You'll have to do a lot better tomorrow when you follow the Sylphon."
"Right. You know, I'm still kind of surprised you didn't want to come with us."
"I will leave one day, Ozzy. Just not yet, that's all."
"But why? You've been here long enough. I can't see you buying into George's idea about how living here as some kind of penance makes us value our lives more. And as far as I can make out, there's no one special for you, is there?"
Which had slowly begun to nag at him as his own suggestions in that direction over the months had all gone unheeded.
"No," she said slowly, "there's no one right now."
"That's a shame, Sarah. We all need someone."
"So, were you going to volunteer?"
The mild scorn in her voice made him pause. After a moment, Sarah stopped and looked back at him.
"What?"
she asked. "Well, goddamn, I couldn't have been any blunter," Ozzy said.
"Blunt about what?"
"About us, you and me. Rocking the mattress.
But you've got..."
"Oh."
"Got what?"
he asked suspiciously.
"I thought... We all thought you and Orion."
"Me and Orion, what?"
"Oh, shit.
You mean he's not your..."
"No. Absolutely
not.
Ah, and I'm not.
Okay, sorry. Misunderstanding there.
Not that there's anything.
No, certainly not. There isn't. I had lots of gay friends.
Did you?
That's what you're supposed to say.
Yeah, right.
Well, that cleared that up then.
It did.
Oh, terrific.
They hurried back up the remainder of the escarpment to the tents in silence. Everyone was inside now. Thick black oil fumes were squirting out of carefully designed vents in the top as the evening meal got underway.
Ozzy, Sarah said in a weary tone just before they went into their tent.
Yo, tomorrow when the Sylphon hunt the ice whales, don't get curious, okay? No matter how exciting or repellent or fascinating you think it is, stay back. Stay right out of their way.
I hear you.
I hope so. I know why you're here. I've seen it in people before. You think you're on some kind of mission. You think that makes you invulnerable. Hell, maybe it does. But take it from me. Tomorrow is not a good time to test it out, okay? I understand your crazy ideas about the Sylphon and how existential they are. But tomorrow it doesn't get more real and physical than this.
I'll be careful, I promise. I've got the kid and the alien to worry about.
They were woken as the first magenta glimmer of dawn appeared. Despite being crammed into the tent with 10 other people, Ozzy had slipped into a deep, dreamless sleep as soon as he zipped up his sleeping bag. It was the first night since he arrived that he hadn't had to endure the ubiquitous red light. He and Orion ate their packaged breakfasts, warding off the edgy, resentful comments from the others who were having their standard ice citadel meal of mashed crystal tree fruit and fried ice whale rashers. They filled their flasks with boiled water. To two, they mixed in the added energy juice powder, and to the second two, they added soup concentrate. While the rest hurried outside to watch the Sylphon begin their hunt, Ozzy and Orion packed their rucksacks for what they hoped was the last time on this world. It had snowed overnight, the wisps of cirrus condensing into tiny hard flakes that drifted down to dust every surface. Ozzy and Orion brushed it off the outer sheet of fur they'd arranged over Tochi's sledge. They dragged it back, with Ozzy partly dreading what they'd find. A stiff corpse. But the heat brick had worked. Tochi waved at them from behind the crystal windscreen, apparently unperturbed by its night spent alone. The pair of them stood beside the sledge, slightly apart from everyone else milling around the tents. It was a good position from which to watch the hunt play out over the land below. Ozzy also realized why the Korokhai had driven the covered sleds up the escarpment yesterday evening. Up here, they were well out of harm's way. Today's hunt was going to range over the expanse of gullies and spinny-crowned hummocks that stretched back from the crater floor. The mounted Sylphon had split into two groups. The first was making their way along the range of crags that plunged out across the crater, heading for the tip, while the second were cantering around the rim away from them. Those on foot were splitting into small parties and fanning out through the spinnies and boulder fields. Ozzy watched with considerable interest as individual riders dropped away from the group moving along the base of the crags to stand a lonely sentry duty just above the uneven shoreline. After 40 minutes, the last rider reached the apex and halted. Facing him, a mile away on the crater rim, the other group was spaced out in a corresponding formation. Somewhere a horn was sounded, its clear note ringing through the frigid air. "Cover your eyes!" Sarah shouted in warning. Ozzy and Orion exchanged a look. No one had mentioned this before. Ozzy quickly stepped in front of the sledge's windscreen. When he glanced back at the crater, he zoomed in on the farthermost rider out at the end of the crags. The Sylphon was perched on his mount, arm back in a classic spear-thrower position. Ozzy just had time to order his retinal insert filters online. The Sylphon threw his spear. Even on full zoom, Ozzy was hard pushed to see the silver splinter as it sliced through the air at an impossible speed. When he checked, he could see the Sylphon on the crater rim opposite had thrown his spear as well.
What?
At the top of their arcs, the spears ignited, stretching out to become lightning bolts. Incandescent white light flashed across the crater, casting the waiting Sylphan riders into stark relief. Red sunlight was momentarily banished in the silent starburst splendor. The twin ribbons of energy dived down into the lake of ice granules. Two blue-white circles of phosphorescence erupted where they vanished below the surface, expanding until they were hundreds of yards across, then slowly dying away.
"What was that?"
Orion cried. "I don't know," Ozzy replied truthfully. He was mildly surprised that the surface of ice granules hadn't shot up like a depth charge explosion, but it remained perfectly calm. A plangent boom rolled in across the landscape, reverberating off the crags and hummocks. The second mounted Sylphon on each wing stood up in their saddles and flung their spears. White light scorched down again. It wasn't until the fourth set of spears had been launched that Ozzy saw movement out in the crater. A low, smooth, arrowhead wave rose up between the twin pools of light and the shoreline, surging along for almost 50 yards before sinking down again. A chorus of joyful chanting rose from the Sylphon waiting for the beasts to be driven ashore, their cadence mingling with the thunderclap of the fourth set of spears. "It's working," Ozzy mumbled inside his balaclava. More bow waves were visible out in the crater now, all of them heading in toward the rim, as the terrifying spears of light continued to fall behind, goading. The two closest to the shore were permanent, rushing forward ever faster. Ozzy held his breath, eager to see an ice whale at long last. The first one burst out of the ice granules 100 yards from the shoreline, a huge, gray, shaggy mountain of fur sliding up into the air with the ease and grace of a dolphin sporting at sea. It was like a polar bear grown to dinosaur size, but with a row of arm-length tusks curving out wickedly from each side of its muzzle. The legs, of which there was a whole series running along its underbelly, were more like fur-clad fins.
"It's huge!"
Orion squeaked.
"Yeah, man. Pretty damn big."
The ice whale surged back into the ice granules, splashing up great gouts of the dry powder. Spears detonated into pure light behind it, converting the billowing cloud of particles into a seething mass of whirling rainbows. Its head rocked about in a fury at this deliberate provocation, but it kept up its dash for the crater rim. Four more waves were close behind it. Individual Sylphon on foot were racing forward, their smaller black spears held above their heads. They had shed their big heavy coats to sprint toward their prey, dark motes skipping grimly over the bleak land. Overhead the sky careered haplessly from red to white, spinning shadows around and around with giddy discord, as the volleys of twinned lightning bolts seared their way along steep curves. Ozzy had seen old documentary videos of soldiers storming ashore in wartime, and the charge of the Sylphon was almost identical to that. A breathtaking insanity that made him want to scream encouragement. The first ice whale reached the rim, and just kept on going at the same speed. Ozzy couldn't believe anything that huge could move so fast. Its head was still scything from side to side, tusks snapping in berserk rage. Sylphon fanned out around it. Several spears were thrown. These didn't burst into a monochromatic blaze, but held true. They had little effect when they struck the flanks of the ice whale. Its matted fur was so thick that most hit and rebounded to clatter on the ground. Those that did manage to stick their tips into whatever flesh was underneath didn't penetrate far. They simply enraged the creature further. Its body bucked and twisted, contorting to allow its legs to scrabble at the slim poles like a dog scratching at fleas. Though Sylphon, who had thrown their spears, started to retreat, several of them were pulling their bows around, ready to shoot arrows. Ozzy had seen no sign of eyes anywhere amid the ice whale's fur, but it seemed to know where its tormentors were. It lunged forward, giant muzzle snapping. Three tusks sliced straight through a Sylphon. Jets of ebony blood squirted from the killer punctures. Then the muzzle sprang open again, ripping the body apart. Legs spun off one way, while the torso flopped to the ground. The ice whale thundered over it, and charged at another Sylphon who was falling backward even as he tried to notch an arrow. Orion screamed in horror.
"It's all right,"
Ozzy shouted. He hugged the boy, turning him away from the carnage. I promise you he's all right. They don't die. Do you understand? The Sylphon don't die. They have an afterlife, a real heaven. The boy was shaking violently inside his embrace.
It ate him,
he wailed.
It ate him!
No, it didn't. It can't. They're too hot. It would burn its mouth away if it tried to do that.
But he's dead!
No, I told you. The Sylphon go to their own heaven. I'm not bullshitting you, man. That's the way they are. Orion clung to him, his head pressed hard against Ozzy's chest.
Will the monsters come for us? Please, Ozzy, I don't want to die. I won't go to heaven. I know I won't.
Hey, Ozzy squeezed reassuringly. Yes, you would. It's me that's headed down into the heat. Why do you think I keep having to get rejuvenated? The big bad dude with the pitchfork and an attitude is all that's waiting for me. There was no answer, no smart or sarcastic comeback. Ozzy hugged the boy again and took a quick look down at the hunt. The last of the aggressive spears from the riders had been flung, leaving the red sun victorious in the battle to light the sky. There were four ice whales on the land now, one of them even bigger than the first to emerge. Each of them was encircled by fast-moving Sylphon on foot. Spears and arrows were fired inward, black flecks shimmering through the air. Most still bounced off the tough, lank fur, though the numbers sticking were increasing. Over a dozen Sylphon were dead already, torn apart or mashed into the unyielding ground. Blood ran thick from their ruined bodies, steaming feverishly and boiling the snow before the pools and runnels started to freeze.
Come on,
Ozzy urged. Let's get inside and take a major break from this bummer. Any residual excitement he'd had at the prospect of witnessing the hunt had long since washed away beneath the guilt of bringing the boy here. He half carried him toward the nearest tent.
They won't come up here, will they?
Orion asked in a pitiful voice.
No, I promise.
Sarah caught sight of them stumbling toward the tent together and hurried over.
Are you all right?
No, he's fucking not, Ozzy barked at her.
You might have told me.
It's a hunt. What did you expect? Ozzy's anger spluttered out. She was quite right. What had I expected it to be like? Just another TSI spectacular? Sarah tugged at the lacing that held the flaps on the outermost layer. Ozzy sneaked another look down below, making sure his body blocked Orion's view. The sight was growing more surreal. The Sylphon death count had risen to over 20. Three of the elfin folk had managed to climb onto the back of an ice whale, hanging on to its fur and riding it like the wildest bronco in the galaxy. As he watched, one of them was swatted by the ice whale's foot, tumbling a long way through the air before crashing onto rock. The surviving two were trying to thrust their spears down into the rough of fur behind its neck, and having a hard time of it. A second ice whale was plowing straight through a spinney of crystal trees. It was like an unstoppable bulldozer, bursting the trunks apart into dangerous, sparkling shrapnel clouds as it hit them head-on. The sound was already reverberating over the escarpment, a city of glass caught in an earthquake. Sylphon were having trouble dodging trees and spinning shards as they ran alongside, trying to take a shot. As for the third ice whale, Ozzy's brow crumpled into a frown. Five dead Sylphon marked its path from the crater. The fight it had given them was tremendous, and now it was weakening, slowing. It had never been so vulnerable. Yet instead of pressing home their advantage, the blood-crazed elven folk were giving it a wide berth. Its back and flanks were pierced by over a dozen arrows and spears. Its head wavered giddily from side to side. Obviously in distress, the ice whale came to an exhausted halt. As it did so, the Sylphon began to form two loose lines, creating an avenue that led back to the crater. They held their spears aloft in salute. The ice whale turned sluggishly and began its long, labored trek back to the crater and the safety of the ice granules. In you go, Sarah said. She'd opened the tent up. Ozzy pushed Orion through the gap and followed him quickly. Sarah came in with them. Orion sat numbly on one of the cots. Ozzy took off his balaclava mask, letting his hair spring out. He produced a thermos out of his coat's big pocket. I want you to drink some of this. It's hot. It'll do you good. The boy made a half-hearted attempt to pull his hood off. Sarah helped him. Then Ozzy almost forced the juice down his throat. He'd never seen the boy look so upset before. Tears were clogging his young, distressed eyes.
Pretty bad, wasn't it?
Orion just nodded mutely. That one they're letting get away, Ozzy said. What's that all about?
The ice whales have a reserve energy store, Sarah said. It's roughly their equivalent of adrenaline hitting the human bloodstream. They use it to get themselves between craters, or fight for territory. Catch their food, too, for all I know. But they take a long time to fill that reserve, and they can burn it off real fast. Once it's run out, they're basically screwed. The Sylphon don't see any sport in hunting something that just sits there while they shoot it full of arrows, so they make sure it gets back to the crater.
They're crazy, Ozzy said. The whole thing is just fucking stupid.
You're the one who thinks they only live at this level to experience, remember?
Yeah. He plunked himself down on the cot next to Orion.
I remember.
Sarah studied the pair of them for a moment.
I've got to get back out there. I'll let you know when the hunt's over. It won't be long.
Thanks. Orion didn't say a word, just sat there with the thermos held in his hands.
It won't happen again, Ozzy said to the boy eventually. Wherever we wind up, it won't be the same as this shit-forsaken dump.
There was a long moment, then Orion suddenly exploded into motion. He clawed at the front of his fur coat, pulling it open. Then he went for his sweater's collar.
I hate them, he yelled. I hate them, Ozzy. They're not what everyone said. They're not my friends. How can I be friends with people who do that?
He pulled out the pendant and tugged hard, breaking the chain.
They're not my friends.
The shimmering pendant was flung across the tent.
What have they done with my parents?
Hey, man, they didn't do nothing to your parents. I promise you that.
How? How can you promise? You don't know.
They're not evil. I know what's happening out there doesn't look nice, but they don't deliberately hurt people.
Your mum and dad will be walking the paths quite happily. Remember what Sarah said. They never showed up here.
You ask me, this planet is a dead end as far as the paths are concerned. The Sylphon don't bother with it much. Orion shook his head and hunched up.
They're so cruel.
These ones are, yeah. All living things seem to be at some stage in their evolution.
We just picked a bad stage to see them at today, is all.
Oh.
The boy sniffed and took a drink of the juice.
Do you think this stage is before they visit Silver Galda, or after?
Hey, good question. I don't know. I'd have to think about it.
I think it's before. You have to know what's awful in the world before you can appreciate what's good.
Shit. How old are you?
Don't know, really. Not out here where the paths mess with time, like Sarah said.
Well, that was totally profound for a 14-year-old.
I'm 15. Probably 16 now.
Okay, 90% profound. Ozzy walked over to the pendant. If you don't mind, I'd like to take this with me.
Orion grunted with perfect teenage sullenness. Don't care.
Good. You never know. It might just guide us to some of the nicer Sylphon.
The pendant was still alight and undamaged. He slipped it into his trouser pocket, where it was less likely to fall out.
You okay now? We should wrap up again and get back out there.
I'm okay, I suppose.
When they emerged from the tent, Tochi had pressed a small strip of parchment up against its sledge windscreen. It read, What is wrong? Ozzy wasn't about to go through the whole writing procedure outside. He made a few simple arm gestures, ending with a thumbs up. Orion was nudged to do the same. Tochi waved at them and withdrew the parchment.
They've killed them, look,
Orion said miserably. Below the escarpment, three ice whales lay dead on the rocky ground, their fur tacky with dark blood from many wounds. Over 30 Sylphon bodies shared their fate. The survivors were gathered around the massive beasts they'd brought down. Ozzy zoomed in on the nearest for a close-up. Two of the Sylphon were hacking their way into the ice whale with long scimitar blades. They'd already peeled back a wide triangular section of the outer skin and were now cutting deep into the body cavity. Gooey fluid and bulbous ribbons of offal spilled out around their feet. He saw them pull out an organ that was half the size of an adult human. The remaining Sylphon gathered around, One by one they cut out a section, and with great ceremony started to eat. Ozzy blinked and pulled his focus back.
I thought they were vegetarians, he said.
You thought wrong, Sarah told him. Ozzy turned to face her.
Wouldn't be the first time.
I came to tell you to get ready, she said. A gesture took in the other five humans who intended to follow the Sylphan. They were all busy, strapping their skis on. They'll be moving on right away.
No more hunting? Ozzy asked.
No.
She paused for a moment.
I know you hated being here, but I'm glad I had the chance to meet you. It's not often people live up to their reputation.
Some of it, anyway.
Thanks, I think. Next time we meet, it'll be different.
There were a lot of ways he could have answered that, but just about everyone would hear.
Let's hope so.
And you, she said to Orion, make him behave.
I'll try,
the boy said from behind his mask.
Ozzy put his own skis on, then checked Orion had fixed his properly. With the boy holding on to the tow rope at the back of Tochi's sledge, Ozzy gave the alien their prearranged signal and pushed off. The escarpment was steep enough to give him a good initial speed. All he had to do was watch for snags and stones that could throw the sledge. Tochi followed him easily, using the four poles with a light touch to steer the sledge along Ozzy's ski tracks. By the time they reached the bottom of the escarpment, the Sylphon were already leaving. The riders had returned, and those on foot had picked up their lanterns. Their voices were raised in cheerful song again. They set off almost directly back the way they came. Ozzy turned to look back up the escarpment. A lone figure was silhouetted against the sky, watching them. But at this distance, he couldn't tell who it was. He knew it would be easy at the start. They'd done nothing energetic the day before. They'd eaten well, and had nearly 7 hours uninterrupted sleep. For the first couple of hours, he had to take care not to slide up into the midst of the Sylphon. Instead, he was content to stay maybe 40 yards or so behind them as they jogged along. Their feet compacted the light sprinkling of snow that drifted above the hard ground, providing a relatively smooth surface for the skis. Tochi also had no trouble keeping pace, staying 5 yards or so behind him. Every time he turned, Orion would be there, a hand raised to wave, to reassure him that everything was okay. The other followers kept a constant speed, two of them staying level with Ozzy and the sledge, while the three most proficient skiers kept up with the Sylphon, determined not to let go of their ticket out. As the afternoon progressed, Ozzy was aware of their line starting to curve away from the route they'd taken out from the ice citadel. The sun gave him a rough guide to their direction, and the massif was slipping farther and farther over to the left. The landscape here began to change. Craters and crags remained the primary features, but they were spaced wider apart, allowing the crystal trees to spread thickly between them, the forests insinuating their way around slopes like the leading edge of some prickly, dark tide. It was both encouraging and frustrating. Encouraging, because he believed that the forests would ultimately provide the path off this bitter world. Frustrating, for the difficulty they added to the journey. The Sylphon barely slowed as they moved under the trees, skipping fluidly around the trunks and saplings without disturbing a branch. For Ozzy it was harder work, even following the widest set of tracks he was having to swerve constantly. Doing that at the pace they set took both concentration and a great deal of physical effort. He forced himself to slow down every 20 minutes to take a drink of the hot juice, fully aware how dangerous dehydration could be in these circumstances. It was surprising how much distance they lost, even halting for the 15 seconds it took to open a thermos and take a couple of gulps, distance that he would then try and regain by traveling faster. After 4 hours he was sweating heavily into his clothes, which were chafing badly. His arms ached. He could hear his heart thudding away loudly. His legs were threatening to cramp. One of the skiers who'd kept level with them was now hundreds of yards behind, and still falling back farther, while of those three originally up with the Sylphon, two had slipped back level with Ozzy. The path the Sylphon were taking was leading them over a whole succession of hummocks, whose steepish slopes were tough going. On either side, the trees were growing taller. They were shapes that Ozzy hadn't seen on this world before. The really tall ones had branches that spiraled upward, as if they'd been neatly pruned and trained around the main bowl, while the broader variety were simple poles with spheres that resembled glass cages clustered along their length, the ones at the base measuring up to a yard across, with those at the tip barely the size of acorns. Particles of ice had accumulated into irregular cloaks on every trunk, though there were no icicles. It was too cold for the frozen particles to shape themselves like that. They'd just reached the crest of one small hill when Orion finally faltered, skidding erratically to a halt as he let go of the tow rope. Tochi immediately jammed his four poles into the ground, braking. The other skiers flashed past as Ozzy turned.
"You okay?" he shouted at Orion.
The boy was bent nearly double. Even through the thick layers of clothing, Ozzy could see him quaking.
"I'm sorry,"
the boy was sobbing.
"I'm sorry. It hurts everywhere. I've got to have a rest."
"Take as long as you want." The timer in Ozzy's virtual vision told him they'd been going for just over 5 hours. The sun would set in another 51 minutes. He pulled a parchment from his coat pocket, struggling to unroll the cold, stiffened sheet. With a charcoal stump held crudely in a mitten, he wrote, "Boy, very tired. Soon, night. Make camp, bottom of hill." Tochi moved about behind the windscreen, lowered its head so that Ozzy could look into its forward eye segment. The patterns flexed and twisted. Roughly translated, they told him, "Also tired. Camp good." When Ozzy looked along the path, he could see just a few twinkles of topaz and jade light through the trees below, as the sylphon moved ever onward. Their singing had long since faded from the air. That was when he realized that the skier who'd fallen far behind hadn't caught up yet. If the man had any sense, he'd try and make it back to the covered sleds tomorrow. Ozzy didn't even know which one of the five it was. Some of them had modern camping gear with them. That might see them through the night. His own confidence was bolstered by knowing their own air-insulated tent was good enough, especially with a heat brick. Orion was taking a big drink from his thermos.
"Yeah, man. Can you make it down to the bottom?" Ozzy asked.
"Yes. I'm really sorry, Ozzy. You two should go on. I can probably make it back to the Ice Citadel."
"Don't be so stupid. It's almost time to stop anyway. I want to be in the tent before the sun goes down."
He picked up the tow rope and handed it to the boy. The track down to the bottom of the hill was undemanding. They kept going for a few minutes more until they found what passed for a small glade. The heavy ice-smothered trees soaked up the red sunlight, turning the forest floor a gloomy crimson. Ozzy pulled their tent from the back of Tochi's sledge and gave it to Orion to sort out, while he set up the rudimentary bone frame and fur covering. Once more he lit a couple of candles in front of the sledge windscreen. He saw the alien pull the tab on a heat brick just as he wormed his way back out of the covering. Orion had pitched their tent a few yards away and was already inside. Drowsy yellow light from the kerosene lamp shone out of the open flap. As he hurried over, the impact of how isolated they truly were struck him. Alone in an Arctic alien forest, without any natural light or heat, when unknown creatures possibly lurked close by. This was the eternal child nightmare that never quite left once adulthood had been reached, not even after 350 years. It wasn't just the cold that was making him shiver as he crawled inside and sealed the flap. Orion made a big show of pulling the tab on a heat brick. The two of them slowly took off their bulky fur coats and over-trousers, then their outer layers of sweaters and trousers. Ozzy plucked at his cold, sweat-sodden checked shirt, wrinkling his nose in disgust. As soon as they'd stopped their exertions, he'd begun to get cold very fast, despite the fur coat. "I'd forgotten how bad it is out there at night," he grumbled.
"I thought we'd be away from here by now,"
Orion said sheepishly.
"We traveled so far."
Ozzy squeezed the boy's shoulder. "Remember the kind of progress we made when we arrived here? You did really well out there today. I was ready to call it a day anyway."
"Thanks, Ozzy. Do you think the others made it?"
"I don't know. Most of them were keeping up with the sylphon."
"I hope they did.
Ozzy opened the bag containing some of their food packages.
What would you like for supper?
Ozzy really didn't want to wake up when his insert alarm went off. Lying snug in the soft, warm folds of the sleeping bag, every limb ached abominably, and as for his abdominal muscles, it was pitch black inside the tent, so he switched his retinal inserts to infrared and searched around for the kerosene lamp. It lit with a flare that made him blink, casting its dreary yellow glow around the interior. The flame from the ice whale oil they used as fuel was soon puffing out a little twist of reeking black smoke.
What's wrong?
Orion coughed. Nothing. It's morning. Time to get up.
You're wrong. It's night still. I've only just got to sleep.
Afraid not, man. Ozzy unzipped the top half of his sleeping bag. His thermal undergarments had dried out, as had the checked shirt and sweaters that were squashed into the bag with him. But the heat brick was all but exhausted, so the gradually cooling air had allowed condensation to form all over the inside of the tent fabric. He tried to put his checked shirt on carefully, but every time a hand caught the side of the tent, little droplets rained down. Orion complained some more as he struggled into action, dressing himself. They pulled the rings on packets of scrambled egg and bacon. For a few glorious moments, the smell of hot food overpowered the dreadful oil. When they were almost ready to venture back outside, Orion asked,
"Do you think we'll get there today?"
"Honestly? I don't know, man. I hope so. But if not, we just keep going. It can't be far now. Not even the Silphin can survive here for long." In his head, their own limit was a constant worry. Between them, they had another 8 heat bricks. That gave them 3 more guaranteed safe nights. They might be able to survive in the tent without one, but it would be an evil night, and Tochi would be finished. How they'd carry the tent and food and other stuff after that was a moot point. They emerged from the odor of the ice whale oil into the numbing cold of the dark forest. It had snowed again overnight, depositing a thin layer over the fur sheet, protecting Tochi's sledge. Once again, anxiety plucked at Ozzy as they pulled it back to see if the big alien had survived. It had. Manipulator Flesh gestured happily to them from behind the windscreen. The tent and coverings and bags were packed away within half an hour. Fortunately, the snowfall hadn't been heavy enough to completely cover the tracks left by the Silphin. Just before they started, Ozzy held up the little friendship pendant. Its sparkle wasn't as strong as yesterday, but tiny slivers of blue light still crawled around inside it. He took that as an encouraging sign and pushed off. A wind picked up, drifting through the forest all morning. It carried little flecks of snow with it, forcing Ozzy to wipe his goggles free every few minutes. Whenever he paused for his drink, he had to go and brush solid flakes off the sledge windscreen. He wasn't sure if it was actually snowing up there above the treetops, or if this was simply residual swirls that the wind was rearranging. It had always puzzled him why the ground here wasn't covered by several feet of snow and ice. Then Sarah had told him that once or twice a year a gale would blow for days, scouring away the loose snow and tiny ice pellets. Somehow that didn't surprise or even bother him. This whole planet was weird. Privately, he considered that it might be as artificial as Silvergalder. He deliberately set a slower pace that morning. Yesterday had been a determined effort to keep up with the Silphin, grasping the faint chance that they might lead him away off the planet before nightfall. There was still an urgency to their trek, but a constant and realistic pace was more important now than pure speed. His new concern was how the little zephyrs were steadily eradicating the compacted footprints, although, as if in compensation, it did seem like the trees had parted slightly to form a rudimentary path through the forest. Lunch was soup again, snatched in the paltry lee of one of the clustered sphere trees. With its snow-coat disguise, it could have passed for a swollen Christmas pine. As before, even a short stop hauled their body temperature down, for which the hot soup seemed unable to compensate. Ozzy hated the sensation of cold sinking into his toes. He couldn't stop worrying about frostbite. When they re-emerged from behind the tree, the falling snow was thicker, eliminating almost all trace of the tracks they'd been following. To make matters worse, it was starting to adhere against the fur of their coats. The sledge was like a small lumpy mound of snow on runners. Ozzy could feel the tiny particles working their way around the rim of his hood. Slender lines of ice were burning against the skin of his cheeks. After a few minutes, the trees began to thin out. While it made skiing slightly easier, it reduced their protection from the wind and ice flakes. It wasn't long after that when the sylphon tracks vanished completely. He slowed to a halt, then had to push off again quickly as Tochi's sledge nearly slid into him. This was what he'd feared happening right from the start, this world's weather closing in on them and losing the path. He fumbled with his mittens, pulling out the friendship pendant. A small bluish glimmer still lurked below the surface. Ozzy turned a complete circle. He thought, possibly, it was a fraction brighter at one point. It was a pretty tenuous assumption to gamble three lives on, but he had nothing else. He went around to the rear of the sledge and found a length of slim rope. With one end tied to his waist and the other to the front of the sledge, he set off again. The wind at least seemed to have died down somewhat, but if anything the snowfall was thicker. He was stopping constantly to check the pendant, while the whole time a treacherous thought in his mind kept asking, why bother? At least when they arrived on the world, he had had the comforting ignorance of believing that nothing bad could happen to any traveller on the sylphan paths. Now he knew his life was on the line, and he was trusting it to a piece of alien jewellery. How tenuous was that? His timer told him they'd been out in the open for 40 minutes, though it felt like most of the afternoon, when he came to the edge of another forest. As soon as they were inside and under the protective boughs, the swirling flakes abated considerably. Ozzy kept the rope tied to the sledge, though. "We'll make camp in a couple of hours," he told his companions. He'd really hoped they could have kept going for longer, but once again this world had thwarted them. He was exhausted by 2 days of battling his way across hostile terrain, and he knew Orion was never going to be able to take much more of this. As for Tochi, well, who knew? But tonight they would have a long rest, which would at least enable them to keep going for another full day. Beyond that, there was nothing to think about. He kept going, moving heavy arms and aching legs in slow rhythm. His feet were numb now, the cold cutting off all feeling below his ankles, which allowed his imagination to summon up the worst-case images of what he'd see when he took his boots off that evening. At least the forest was on a gentle downward slope. There were mounds and ridges, of course, but the overall progress was helpful. He wasn't sure if he could manage another big uphill slog. The snow was deeper, too, covering all the usual stones and snags. Several times he shook it off his fur coat where it was clinging.
"Ozzy!"
He turned at the shout, seeing Orion waving frantically. Now what? Despite the nerves that were getting badly stretched, he signaled Tochi to stop and skied around to the boy. Orion pulled his goggles off.
"It's wet," he exclaimed.
Instead of shouting at the boy to put the goggles back on, he leaned in closer to see what had happened.
"The snow," Orion said. "It's melting. It's warm enough to melt."
Sure enough, the ice on the goggles seemed to be mushy, sleet rather than ice. Ozzy snatched his own goggles off and looked straight up. A million dark specks were falling out of the uniform coral pink sky. When they landed on his exposed skin, they didn't sting and burn as they had before. They were wintry, yes, but they quickly turned to slush and dribbled over his skin. Ozzy propelled himself over to the closest tree. He raised a pole and whacked it hard against the trunk. The snow loosened, falling away. He hit it again and again until the bark was exposed. Real, biological bark. It was a proper, wooden tree. He laughed with more than a touch of hysteria. It was a stupid irony that he'd gotten so cold he couldn't actually tell when the environment warmed up to a mere 10 degrees below freezing. Orion had churned his way over. He looked at the exposed patch of crinkled bark with trepidation.
"We did it!"
Ozzy shouted, and flung his arms around the boy.
"We fucking did it! We are gone from that bastard world! Out, out, out! I'm free again!"
"Are we? Have we really escaped?"
"Oh, goddamn yes. You bet your sweet ass we have. You and me, kid, we did it. Oh, hey, and Tochi, of course. Come on, let's go tell it the good news."
"But Ozzy..."
Orion glanced up.
"The sky's still red.
Yeah. He squinted up at it, not wanting to damage the image, although it was a very bright pink, especially for this time of day. That is, the time of day on his digital timer. If they were on a different world, I don't know. There's more than one red star in the galaxy. He tugged out his battered parchment as he slid over to the front of the sledge and wrote, "I think we made it. Can you keep going a little while longer?" "As long as I live." When Ozzy held the friendship pendant up, the spark of light had almost vanished. "This way, I think," he said, and pushed off once again, not that he was really worried about direction now. Physically, the conditions had hardly changed, but simply knowing they were clear of the dreadful ice citadel world allowed his body to tap some previously unknown energy reserve. "Just like an ice whale," he told himself. Of course, now he knew what to look for. The signs were obvious. The thick snow, different types of tree with bony branches outlined against the sky, the lighter sky itself. With every yard they moved forward, things changed. It wasn't long before he saw thin, henna-colored wisps of grass sticking out above the snow. Then there were little rodent creatures scampering about around the trees. Branches shed little piles of snow to fall around them with constant wet thudding sounds as the thaw grew. They were heading down quite a steep slope now, losing height rapidly. The end of the forest was abrupt. Ozzy shot past the last trees and onto a snowfield that was broken by boulders and widening patches of orange-tinted grass. They were halfway along some massive valley created by alp-sized mountains. A lake of beautifully clear water stretched out below them, extending for 20 miles on either side. Its shores were also ringed with trees, whose dark branches were just starting to bud. The snowfield died out completely about half a mile ahead of them, with the grass sliced by hundreds of little seasonal streams as the melting edge slowly retreated upward. On either side, the tree line was almost constant, drawing a broad boundary between the lower grass slopes of the mountains and their rocky upper levels. When he looked back at the forest he'd just come from, Ozzy was sure it would only take 5 minutes or so to ski through, yet they'd paused a good quarter of an hour ago. A brilliant sun was rising at one end of the valley, and he finally understood the pink sky. They had come out of a gloomy maroon nightfall and straight into a vibrant dawn. Ozzy slowly pushed his hood back and smiled into the strengthening light as it began to warm his skin.